This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents The Daily Show with Jon Stewart presents America the Book, the audiobook, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. America the Book, the audiobook, is intended to give students a basic understanding of the fundamental underpinnings of the United States government, its history, and its people. It should not be considered a replacement for watching television. And now a word from TV's Jon Stewart.
Hi, I'm TV's Jon Stewart. Welcome, non-reader, and congratulations. You're about to embark on an exciting journey of sound, a journey through history, through civics, through social studies. It gets better. But first, a word from one of our founding fathers.
Foreword by Thomas Jefferson.
When America the Book, the audiobook, first approached me about penning the foreword to their tome, I was surprised. Firstly, the foreword is not my bailiwick, but rather the Declaration. Forgive my conceit, but if one is looking to introduce a grand composition with a pithy and clear pronouncement, my declaratives are second to none. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Google it, if ye doubt the claim. Also of some concern, I have been dead for... Oh, Lord, has it really been 178 years? My goodness, time certainly flies when you are no longer consigned to your earthly vessel. Notwithstanding, Irv over at Warner Books sent me some galleys, and I have to say, funny. Not John Winthrop's A Comparative Treatise on the Most Unusual of Distinctions Twixt the Fairer of Species and Her Masculine Counterpart funny, but funny. Of course, Sally was less enthused. You are the author of the Declaration of Independence, a scholar, a statesman. This is beneath you. It's not even network. But truth be told, I was itching to get back to the quill and paper, and declaration work is not as steady as it used to be. Sally may not like it, but as we used to say in the back parlors of 18th-century Paris, tough titties. I was also looking forward to this opportunity to dispel some of the mythology surrounding myself and my fellow founders, particularly the myth of our infallibility. You moderns have a tendency to worship at the altar of the fathers. The First Amendment is sacrosanct. We will die to protect the Second Amendment. So dramatic. Do you know why we called them amendments? Because they amend. They fix mistakes or correct omissions, and they themselves can be changed. If we had meant for the Constitution to be written in stone, we would have written it in stone. Most things were written in stone back then, you know. I'm not trying to be difficult, but it's bothersome when you blame your own inflexibility and extremism on us. Not that we weren't awesome. We wrote the Constitution in the time it takes you nimrods to figure out which is the I button and which is the nay. But we weren't gods. We were men. We had flaws. Adams was an unbearable prick and squealed girlishly whenever he saw a bug. And Ben Franklin? If crack existed in our day, that boozed-up snuff machine would weigh 80 pounds and live outside the Port Authority. And I had slaves. Damn, I can't believe I had slaves. Yes, we were very accomplished. We discovered electricity, invented stoves, bifocals, the Lazy Susan, efficient printing presses, and the swivel chair. But in the 18th century, it was nearly impossible not to invent something. What if we put this refuse in a receptacle? Oh my God, you just invented a sanitation system. We lived in primitive times. Hell, I shit in a bucket, and I was the president. But I digress. My point is, composing the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution was hard work. God didn't dictate it for us to transcribe from some sort of dictation transcribing machine. Hey, did I just invent something? Do you have anything like that? You do? Well, our purpose was to create a living document based on principles that transcended the times we lived in, and I think we did that. We created a blueprint for a system that would endure, which means your lazy asses shouldn't be coasting on our accomplishments. We were imperfect. It was imperfect, and we expect our descendants to work as hard as we did on keeping what we think is a profoundly excellent form of government supple, evolving, and relevant. After hearing this audiobook, you should be better prepared to do just that. As always, Thomas Jefferson. Oh, P.S. Is it true that Halle Berry is once again single? If so, I'd be forever in your debt if you would put in a good word for T.J. Oh, how I loves the mochaccina.
Chapter 1. Democracy Before America. In this chapter, you will witness thousands of years of history casually dismissed in a few minutes. Learn the difference between a totalitarian regime and a post-communist kleptocracy. Realize that no matter how horrible your life is, it's not as bad as a feudal serf's.
It is often said that America invented democracy. This view is, of course, an understatement. America invented not only democracy, but freedom, justice, liberty, and time-sharing. But representative democracy is unquestionably our proudest achievement, the creation most uniquely our own. Even if the rest of the Western world would have come up with the idea themselves by the 1820s. So why, then, has participation in this most wondrous system withered? As heirs to a legacy more than two centuries old, it is understandable why present-day Americans would take their own democracy for granted. A president freely chosen from a wide-open field of two men every 4 years, a Congress with a 99% incumbency rate, a Supreme Court comprised of nine politically appointed judges whose only oversight is the icy scythe of death. All these reveal a system fully capable of maintaining itself. But our perfect democracy, which neither needs nor particularly wants voters, is a rarity. It is important to remember there still exist many other forms of government in the world today, and that dozens of foreign countries still long for a democracy such as ours to be imposed on them. To regain our sense of perspective and wonder, we must take a broader historical view, looking beyond America's relatively recent success story to examine our predecessors and their adorable failures. In this chapter, we will briefly explore the evolution of an idea, following the HMS Democracy on a dangerous voyage through the mists of time, past the Straits of Monarchy, surviving Hurricane Theocracy, then navigating around the Cape of Good Feudal System to arrive battered, but safe, at her destined port of call, Americatown. Early man, more animal than political. The human race is by nature brutal, amoral, unreasonable, and self-centered. But for the first few hundred thousand years of our existence as a species, we were way too obvious about it. Primitive culture centered on survival of the individual, and occasionally survival of someone the individual might want to reproduce with. Civic institutions were non-existent, as was debate, which would appear later after the invention of the frontal lobe. For prehistoric man, the rule of law, such as it was, could best be summed up by the seminal case Marbury's Head versus Madison's Rock. Early man lived this tenuous Darwinian nightmare for an age or two, until a peculiar thing happened. The unfittest decided they wouldn't mind surviving either. The feeble and weak realized that without a good plan, they weren't going to make it out of the Stone Age to see the wonder that was clay. Alone, they were mammoth meat. Together, they would become a force, with a chance to see the day when their children's children would be only 75% covered in hair. From these noble impulses, the groundwork for the first civilizations was laid. Athens, our big fat Greek forerunners. Ancient Greece is widely credited with creating the world's first democracy. It would be a worthy endeavor to travel back in time to the Phaedo-strewn shores of 5th century B.C. Athens and ask Plato to define democracy, and not only to make money gambling on Olympic results that we, being from the future, would already know. Plato would tell us, in that affectionate but non-sexual way of his, that democracy is a Greek word, combining the roots for people, demos, and rule, kratia. In Greek democracy, political power was concentrated not in the hands of one person, or even a small group of people, but rather evenly and fairly distributed among all the people, meaning every John Q. Publicopolis could play a role in Athenian government. The main legislative body, the Assembly, was comprised of no less than the first 6,000 citizens to arrive at its meetings. And bear in mind, no saving seats. Jury duty was considered an honor to be vied for. Membership in most other civic institutions, including the Supreme Court, was chosen by lot. Imagine a system in which anyone could wind up serving on the Supreme Court. Anyone. Think about your own family, friends, the guys you knew in college who would eat dog feces for $10. Now picture him as the randomly chosen Chief Justice, and you'll appreciate just how fucked up this system was. Compared with American democracy, the Athenian version seems simplistic, naive, and gay. Yet transcripts of early Athenian policy debates reveal a populace moved more by eloquence and rationality than demagogues and fear-mongering. Thankfully, this type of humane governance wasn't allowed to take root. Athens' great experiment ended after less than two centuries, when, in 338 BC, Philip of Macedon's forces invaded the city, inflicting on its inhabitants the eternal fate of the noble and enlightened, to be brutally crushed by the armed and dumb. Rome, the First Republicans. The fall of Athens was followed by the emergence overnight of Rome. At first glance, its people appear to have enjoyed a system of representative government similar to ours. True, behind its facade of allegedly representative officials lurked a de facto oligarchy ruled by entrenched plutocrats. But the similarities don't end there. In fact, the Founding Fathers borrowed many of their ideas from the Roman model, including its bicameral legislature, its emphasis on republicanism and civic virtue, and its Freudian fascination with big white columns. However, there was very little real democracy in Rome. While the Senate theoretically represented the people, in reality, its wealthy members covertly pursued pro-business legislation on behalf of such military-industrial giants as Javelin Corps, United Crucifix, and a cartel of resource-exploiting companies known as Big Aqueduct. They even monopolized the most notorious aspect of Roman life, instituting an orgy policy that can literally be described as trickle-down. Vomitoriums aside, Rome's biggest contribution to American government was probably its legal system, which codified key concepts like equal protection, innocent until proven guilty, and the right to confront one's accusers. These very same issues would later form the basis of both the Bill of Rights and a mind-numbing quantity of law and order scripts. But by the time of Rome's huge millennium celebration marking the beginning of 0 AD, the faint light of Roman democracy was all but extinguished. The Republic had given way to empire. The only voting to speak of took place in the Colosseum and was generally limited to a handful of disembowelment-related issues. In time, the empire itself fell. As history teaches us, all empires inevitably must. Its most enduring legacy, a numerical system that allowed future generations to easily keep track of Super Bowls. The Magna Carta, power to the extremely wealthy people. And then, darkness. For more than 1,000 years, democracy disappeared from the European scene. The period instead saw the blossoming of an exciting array of alternate forms of government, such as monarchy, absolute monarchy, kingship, queenhood, and three different types of oppression, religious, ethnics, and for shits and giggles. As for individual liberty, innocent until proven guilty was rapidly supplanted by a more aggressive law and order approach better characterized as guilty until proven flammable. Democracy had disappeared. The people needed a champion. And as is usually the case, the obscenely rich rode to the rescue. In 1215, England's wealthy barons refused to give King John the money he needed to wage war unless he signed the Magna Carta. The document codified that no man was above the law. Unfortunately for the peasant class, it did little to address how many were below it. Startlingly ahead of its time, this extraordinary document had a profound effect on people and continues to shape 21st century views on topics as diverse as eschat, sausage, beurage, novel disseisin, and the bailiwicks of Gerard of Athy. But even more importantly, the Magna Carta set a powerful precedent for our own founding fathers. There was no more powerful means of safeguarding individual liberty than a vaguely worded manifesto inked in inscrutable cursive on dilapidated parchment. The Magna Carta served as a wake-up call that Europe would be forced to answer in about 500 years. For Lady Democracy, having lain dormant for more than a millennium, had risen from its slumber only to stretch its arms, reach for the clock, and groggily set the snooze bar for the Enlightenment. The 17th and 18th centuries, enlightening strikes. Though a promising development for democracy, the Magna Carta was mostly ignored as the world plunged into what would be known as the Dark Ages. It was an apt title for an era when amoebic dysentery was considered the good kind of dysentery. Oppression and high mortality rates seemed ready to swallow what remained of mankind, when through the darkness emerged the light that would be its salvation. Reason. It began slowly. Hey, what if we stop storing the corpses in the drinking water and see if that makes any difference to our health? From there, it gathered momentum. Soon, all conventional wisdom, from the shape of the earth to whether the ruling class could have your hut burned and your organs removed because they thought you caused an eclipse, was up for grabs. This last question proved especially pertinent for the future of democracy and ushered in an era known as the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, with its emphasis on reason, would finally provide democracy with its philosophical underpinnings. The 17th and 18th centuries produced a wave of prominent thinkers espousing political systems based on what they called the social contract. Government, they theorized, was a sort of legal agreement between the rulers and the ruled, the terms of which were binding on both parties. It was a groundbreaking theory. All they needed now was some country dumb enough to try it before the king found out and had them all drawn and quartered. Democracy needed a fresh start. Hardy and idealistic champions who would strike out for a new world, willing to risk everything for the principles of equality, liberty, justice, and slaves. We'd need some slaves and guns, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. A new world awaited.
Supplemental material. The Ages of Democracy, a guide.
Like snowflakes or sting albums, no two democracies are exactly alike, but they all tend to follow the same basic pattern. This guide will help steer you through the turning points of your democracy's life.
Infancy.
Congratulations! You've ended your religious, economic, ethnic repression and thrown off the yoke of your despot, king, Ayatollah, through a bloody, bloodless war, coup, voluntary exile. Now it's time to choose your first leader. He may have commanded your war effort, but could also be a prominent exile returning home from his villa on the Côte d'Azur. First step, draft a new constitution. Use pencil. Next, hold your first election. Is it fraudulent? Don't worry. Everybody's proud of you just for trying. Here's a tip. Naming a new national capital? Why not call it, insert your country, city?
Childhood.
Your democracy is up and running. You're ready to organize political parties. One, ideally, two, if necessary. During these formative years, they'll prove invaluable in furnishing your citizens with opinions. Plenty of exciting discoveries await, but remember, youthful exuberance can sometimes lead to violent acting out. Control yourself. Hire a police force, preferably led by some of the people you overthrew. Other milestones to look for? First war, writing national anthem about that war, and collecting taxes all by yourself, like a big country. Here's a tip. It's also a good time to free any Nobel Peace Prize winners you may have incarcerated.
Adolescence.
A democracy's most turbulent time. It usually starts with an assassination, waves of revenge killings, Les Miserables, and ends with a civil war, or population adjustment. In between, you'll undergo a rapid growth spurt, possibly involving the annexation of Texas. Your relationship with your founders will change. You'll find yourself questioning whether they had it all wrong when it came to, for instance, slavery. Physically, your private sector will mature, your mineral deposits will start surfacing, and you will experience the first stirrings of interest in women, specifically in letting them vote. Here's a tip. You may also notice dissidents where you formerly had none. Don't worry, this is normal, and they can always be arrested.
Adulthood.
The prime of your life. By now you know who you are and which UN committee you chair. Your natural resources are at the peak of their exportability. It's time to think about building a future, settling down with the right alliances, maybe even raising little colonies of your own. But with success comes new responsibility. Other nations are now counting on you for aid and peacekeeping troops. You may find yourself compromising your youthful ideals, supporting regimes you know are violating human rights. Don't beat yourself up about it. You have to trade with someone. Here's a tip. With the free press firmly in place, you may see the first appearance of political satire. Ignore it. It can do no harm.
Middle age.
One day, your democracy will look in the mirror and behold a scary sight. Voter turnout is thinning. Your welfare system is bloated. You're completely dominated by corporate interests, and you haven't had a proper election in years. When this happens, a nation may go through a midlife crisis, seeking solace in superficial toys like satellite-based lasers to shoot down missiles or action stars turned politicians. Don't be surprised if old allies decide to leave you and start referring to you as a once-great nation. Ultimately, you will have to decide whether to quietly make peace with your declining power or to go out in a blaze of glory, taking Mideast peace or world fish stocks or the ozone layer with you. Here's a tip. Many middle-aged democracies find themselves turning to religion for strength, so don't be embarrassed to erode church-state separation provisos.
Old age.
Your legislative sessions now deal almost exclusively with health care and social security. The dependent nations you've created no longer want anything to do with you. But worst of all, your mind is going. The best and brightest of your nation shun public service, and the resulting brain drain racks your bureaucracies, rendering you unable to perform even the most basic tasks, like balancing a budget or conducting a legitimate election. Your body politic is clogged with incumbents, and worst of all, your vice president once played someone named the Geech on a UPN sitcom. By the end, you can't even recognize your own ideals. Your few remaining friends may be tempted to end your misery and bomb you out of love. But at least they can take some small comfort in the saying, old democracies never die. They just get overthrown by military juntas or peasant insurrectionists or rural militias.
Discussion questions. 1. If you lived in a monarchy, would you rather be the king or a slave? Why or why not? 2. What is the central ideological difference between democracy and cannibalism? 3. You're a 5th century Greek city-state growing increasingly concerned over repeated Persian incursions into the central Peloponnesian peninsula. How many hoplites can you dispatch to Thermopylae without jeopardizing the triremes commanded by Themistocles for the naval engagement at Artemisium? Show your work. 4. Does the expression, when in Rome, do what the Romans do, apply to all cities, or just Rome? 5. The notion that each individual has worth in society found political expression in the invention of democracy. What's bullshit about this? 6. Is direct democracy practical today? In a nation as big as ours, is it really possible to simultaneously gather the opinions of 300 million people? Log on to www.americathebook.com and vote in our poll. Classroom activities. 1. Have your students draw a topographical map of ancient Greece. For every elevation they get wrong, punch one in the arm. 2. Give your students a taste of Athenian life before democracy by implementing a draconian measure, like forcing them to wear togas to class every day for a month. Then celebrate democracy by being named the principal defendant in a class action lawsuit against the school. 3. Have the class perform a real-time, period-accurate reenactment of the Protestant Reformation. That should buy you plenty of time to step outside for a smoke. Chapter 2, The Founding of America. In this chapter, you will learn about the founding mothers and find out which ones were FMILFs. Not fire until you see the whites of their eyes. Become increasingly skeptical of the author's scholarship. Get sick of always hearing about how great Ben Franklin was.
It had been hundreds of thousands of years since man first made his presence felt on planet Earth. But had it been time well spent? Our species' progress had been steady but slow. Man had survived, but with precious little to show for his time, a frustration summed up in the famous cave drawing entitled, "Enough Already with the Hunting and the Gathering." Of course, there had been great accomplishments along the way. Fire was a winner. Walking upright went a long way towards easing back pain. Even the wheel, the boat, and language would prove quite useful, especially on the heels of the less successful parallelogram, rock, and grunting. All wonderful innovations that would, in their own tiny way, advance the cause of man. But nothing yet accomplished would rival in importance the discovery, colonization, and eventual democratization of the New World. Yes, America would become what de Tocqueville described as the total package. America's journey from undiscovered frontier to independent nation to transcendently perfect beacon of freedom was long, complex, and fascinating. But to fully understand this journey, you only have to memorize three dates. 1492. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue and discovered America. Now, some have argued Columbus actually discovered the West Indies, or that Norsemen had discovered America centuries earlier, or that you really can't get credit for discovering a land already populated by indigenous people with a developed civilization. Those people are communists. Columbus discovered America. 1620. In 1620, the Pilgrims landed dressed real queero. The next great date in the history of American democracy marked the Pilgrims' establishment of the first successful New World colony. Now, some have argued the first established colony was actually the ill-fated Roanoke colony, or the slightly better-fated Jamestown colony. Those people are mentally ill. Roanoke and Jamestown do not count, because both settlements lacked the key ingredient necessary for the successful colonization of America, religious fanaticism. Plymouth succeeded because its inhabitants did not come to the New World searching for glory, adventure, or hot man-on-Indian action. Rather, the Pilgrims had come to escape religious persecution, to create a society where they could worship as they pleased, and one day, God willing, even do some persecuting of their own. Said John Winthrop, the first elected leader of the Plymouth colony,
"In England, we were looked upon crossly for what they deemed our most unusual form of Puritan orthodoxy. Well, I say unto those whose gaze be deemed disapproving, you call that persecution? Dirty looks? Watch as I have this young girl burned alive for having hiccups."
Interestingly, almost 400 years after the foundation of the Puritans' Plymouth colony, the state of Massachusetts became the first to guarantee the constitutionality of gay marriage. This act was misconstrued as a bold move forward in the cause of equality, but in reality, was just a hilarious fuck you to the Pilgrims. 1776. In 1776, the Declaration of Independence was signed. Dicks. Finally, the date of destiny. July 4th, 1776. The day America officially broke with England. The day brave patriots signed a document stating, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." The date most historians refer to as democracy's money shot. But was our journey to independence inexorable? Or had it been, as some have claimed, exorable? Consider this remarkable fact. The United States of America, the greatest country in the history of the world, would not exist had England simply been less stingy with the chamomile. Prelude to revolution. You can't spell tyranny without T. Through most of colonial history, inhabitants of the 13 colonies were loyal subjects of the British crown, resourceful, dedicated, and as the third Duchess of Kent was fond of saying,
"Some tea-drinking motherfuckers."
In fact, whenever the subject of the New World was mentioned within earshot, the the Duchess could always be counted on for a wistful headshake and a hearty...
Motherfuckers love that motherfucking tea.
Yes, tea was not just a hot beverage in late 18th century America. It was the hot beverage. So it came as quite a shock to the colonists when, in 1773, the British government outsourced all American tea jobs to the East India Company, an offshore British multinational. In addition, the Crown passed the Tea Act, raising the tariff on tea 1/8 pence per dram, the modern equivalent of $5 million per tea bag. But the English-American relationship had been deteriorating for some time. In 1765, King George II imposed the Stamp Act, which, in conjunction with the equally harsh Coin Act and Action Figure Act, decimated colonial America's burgeoning nerd community. Their anger was soon given a voice by Pennsylvanian John Dickinson, who eloquently argued for greater colonial self-government in his classic Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer, and of course its less popular sequel, The Pennsylvania Farmer and the Goblet of Fire. The first major act of violence occurred in 1770, when British troops fired into an angry mob and killed five citizens in what came to be called the Boston Massacre. Yes, it was a happier, simpler time when five deaths were seen as a massacre, not the natural consequence of, say, a Detroit Pistons championship celebration. But it was the 1773 Tea Act that proved the tipping point in America's struggle for independence. The colonists gathered to debate their next move. Inspiration came in the form of Jebediah Sondheim, a New York-based wheelwright and lyricist, whose catchy slogan, "No taxation without representation," galvanized the populace and marked the birth of a great American political tradition, the reductionist rhyming chant. But the Tea Act required immediate action. There would be no out-of-town previews. There were only 2 weeks until opening night, people. 2 weeks. And so, on a cold December night, a party of Bostonians dressed as Mohawk Indians boarded ships anchored in the harbor and dumped thousands of pounds of tea into the Atlantic. British authorities immediately closed the harbor and clamped down on the Massachusetts government, a move brewer patriot Samuel Adams called in Ye Boston Globe, "wicked retatted." Months later, the battles of Lexington and Concord would make reconciliation impossible. England and her colony America would be forever separate. How did this come to pass? Perhaps no one summed it up more eloquently than the Third Duchess of Kent.
Fuck with a motherfucker's tea and the shit be on.
The Declaration of Independence, brittle parchment of liberty. If you are going to sever ties to your commonwealth through bloody struggle, it is considered polite to write down why. Nobody wants to get 3 years into a revolution, only to realize the whole thing was a Three's Company-esque misunderstanding. The Declaration of Independence was the laundry list of grievances stating America's case for freedom. Its accusations against the king ranged from the egregious,
"He has plundered our seas, burnt our towns, and ravaged the lives of our people,"
to the trifling,
"Sometimes when he sees us at a party, he acts like he doesn't know us."
But proud men would not take up arms against the crown solely because the king had erected a multitude of new offices. The authors of the Declaration knew they would also have to appeal to man's higher nature to stir men's souls. They needed something with some zazz. Enter a young hotshot tobacco executive from Virginia, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson had had great success marketing tobacco. His task now would be to synthesize the unique brand message of America down to something that would captivate the hard-to-reach 12 to 28 ragtag militia demographic, all while not offending traditional butter-churn moms. His first attempt at a preamble was,
"America. A is for all the tea they taxed. M is for the minutemen they shellaxed."
It tested poorly, but his rewrite would be a win-win.
"We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
In a scant 35 words, Jefferson had given the nation the kind of positive brand identity that rendered moot the issue of whether or not we had to live up to its ideals. Still, Knowing the inherent contradiction in the words of the Declaration and the reality of a slave-owning nation, Jefferson and the founders wisely decided to strike from the Declaration of Independence the phrase, "or your money back." The Declaration of Independence was signed and announced on July 4, 1776. A new nation was born. The founding fathers could now retire back to their respective states, knowing that all that was left to achieve was for their untrained militias to engage and defeat the most powerful empire the world had ever seen. The Constitution. Let's get this party started right. The founders realized a country forged in war would need a powerful legal blueprint to preserve its hard-won peace. The Articles of Confederation, drafted between 1776 and 7 and ratified in 1781, was not that document. A series of confusing provisions, such as Article 4, see Article 12. Article 18, this is not an article, and Article 12, see Article 4. The Articles vested the majority of power in the state's hands, a poor idea given South Carolina's immaturity and how angry New Hampshire got when it was drunk. Why did the Articles fail so completely? Most historians believe the Founding Fathers spent a great deal of their first constitutional convention drafting the Declaration of Independence and only realized on July 3rd that the Articles were also due. By 1787, the inadequacy of this poorly conceived document was apparent to even the dimmest of framers. That summer, 55 of the country's greatest minds, led by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, once again convened in Philadelphia. This time, their mission would not be dissolving bonds, but forging them, and in so doing, giving birth to a new, permanent, glorious law, forever linking the diverse components of a young nation destined to spread across the continent. They would name it the Constitution, after Hamilton's mother. If the Declaration was our nation's sales pitch, the Constitution would be its owner's manual, and as the Founding Fathers knew all too well, no one ever reads the owner's manual. The Constitution would have to effectively vest power in the hands of the people, republicanism, without undermining the importance of central authority, federalism. It would be an all-encompassing document. The first few drafts even included recipes. To achieve that balance, the founders ultimately conceived the three branches of government, a notion ensuring the separation of powers through a series of checks and balances. It was a system reflecting the founders' belief that children should memorize not just dates, but also phrases. But on what basis should the three branches be divided? It came down to two dueling ideas. Madison's proposal of an executive, judicial, and legislative branch versus George's Joseph Morton's proposal to dole out power according to
the presence, forbearance, rectitude, and largiosity of one's plums and carrot.
After much deliberation, it was decided Madison's proposal would be accepted, Morton relenting only after the Constitutional Convention agreed to proclaim him, quote, impressive. The three branches would, in essence, police each other with an elaborate system of safeguards and precautions that would prevent power from being concentrated in too few hands. Quipped a jubilant Hamilton,
the only way it could fail is if one party gains control of not just the executive, but also the Senate and House chambers, and upon doing so, proceeds to bring in like-minded judges.
And then the framers all laughed. Ultimately, the Constitution provided our fledgling democracy, America, with a bulwark against tyranny, a foundation based upon the rule of law, equality, and a respect for the individual and property the world had not yet seen. They even graciously included a manner to amend the document as circumstances dictated for future generations. The founders prayed only that this Constitution be ratified, respected, and upheld, and that nobody would tell the black people about it.
Supplemental material. Your unelectable founders.
For their times, the Founding Fathers boasted relatively impressive credentials. But would their so-called genius hold up against the more rigorous standards which we demand of today's office seekers? Who were these renegades, these upstarts who dared challenge the might and majesty of Great Britain. The founders represented a cross-section of colonial society and a broad range of political beliefs. We think of them as one unified body, but in reality, their relations were fraught with tension, like the heated December 1775 exchange at Carpenter's Hall, when Patrick Henry referred to John Hancock as fucknuts. But as deliberations over independence wore on, leaders emerged. Libraries worth of books have been penned about each of these men of genius, whose extraordinary achievements and revolutionary ideas are virtually impossible to encapsulate. We do so here.
Benjamin Franklin.
He was the 10th of 17 children and had classic 10th child personality. He wrote the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, the book he was born to write. He proved lightning was electricity by flying a kite, vindicating 20 years of meaningless kite flying. He wrote immortal maxims like, $2,145.34 saved is $2,145.34 earned. Figures have been adjusted for inflation. He invented the Franklin stove, glass harmonica, bifocals, and essentially Philadelphia. He was world famous, universally beloved, and he loved a good fart joke. Why would he be unelectable today? He loved the ladies. Loved them old, young, fat, thin, whatever. Couldn't get enough. Just loved them. Also, he once wrote, quote, "As to Jesus, I have some doubts as to his divinity." Kiss the red states. Goodbye.
Thomas Jefferson.
He wrote the Declaration of Independence, still highly regarded in some circles. He served as America's first Secretary of State, second Vice President, and third President, thus completing an unprecedented governmental triple crown. He masterminded the Louisiana Purchase, doubling the size of the United States, while simultaneously halving its quality. He tinkered with architecture, futzed around in mechanical engineering. He was a botany hobbyist, animal husbandry buff, and enjoyed recreational paleontology. His personal book collection became the Library of Congress, so probably read a bit. He dabbled in French, Spanish, Italian, Latin, Greek, Anglo-Saxon, and wasn't averse to the occasional state university founding. He was an expert on viticulture, whatever the hell that is. Why would he be unelectable today? Miss Hemmings, Connie Chung on line one.
George Washington.
He was the first and arguably greatest president, first and arguably greatest commander-in-chief, first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen, first prize 1764 Williamsburg bake-off, profiteroles a la George. He holds the all-time record most places slept. He carried himself in a manner that was, well, almost Reagan-esque. In his will, he ordered Martha to free their slaves after her death. A nice gesture. Unfortunately, Martha lived to be 197 years old. Why would he be unelectable today? Bad teeth and syphilis.
John Adams.
He was the most influential figure in the Continental Congress due to primo alphabetical position. He drafted the Massachusetts Constitution in 1780, though delegates from his state refused to ratify the letter R. He was the first vice president, setting the standard by doing nothing for 8 years, then making it through his own presidency in half the time. He was the forebear of a long line of distinguished public servants, including his son, John Quincy, the sixth president, great-grandson Henry, historian, cousin Sam, brewer patriot, and great-great-grandnephew Grizzly, a bearded outdoorsman. He claimed he was willing to make principled, unpopular decisions. Why would this founding father be unelectable now? He actually made principled, unpopular decisions.
Alexander Hamilton.
He was the author of the majority of the Federalist Papers, including the least boring ones. A frequent foe of Jefferson, he put his own face on the $10 bill, Jefferson's on the $2. Smart move. He French-bashed before it was cool. He was a huge fan of democracy. If his, quote, "the people are turbulent and changing, they seldom judge or determine right," is any indication. He founded the New York Post in 1801, dubbing the young Andrew Jackson Wacko Jacko. Why would he be unelectable? He was born in the West Indies, so constitutionally, his presidency would have been impossible. He also had an unfortunate tendency to duel and lose.
James Madison.
Known as the father of the Constitution and co-author of the Federalist Papers, Madison sponsored the Bill of Rights. He was the guarantor of church-state separation and creator of the checks and balances system. He was a consistently popular two-term president and chief negotiator for the Louisiana Purchase. Madison lived a blameless life and died with no enemies. Still, he remained less beloved than his wife, Dolly. Why would he be unelectable today? He stood 5'4" and would weigh 108 pounds even after the camera added 10.
The Founding Mothers? An essay by Rob Corddry.
When the editors of this book asked me to contribute an essay or two, I only had one question. ¿Cuánto dinero por mí? Having resolved that issue, I was presented with the challenge of writing on a subject I admittedly knew little, okay, nothing, about. The Founding Mothers. Here's what I found on the internet.
Betsy Ross.
Everybody knows Betsy Ross was the one who got it all sewed up in the theme song for that show Maude. But what you may not have known is the thing she sewed up was the American flag. I'm talking about Old Glory, the old red, white, and blue, Old Ironsides, Captain Jack. I did some research, and it turns out if Betsy Ross was alive and sewing American flags today, she'd be a 13-year-old Laotian boy.
Abigail Adams.
Abigail Adams was the wife of President John Adams and was widely considered his intellectual equal. He must have been pretty stupid. In fact, she once wrote to her husband, "Remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors," making her one of the country's first feminists. My guess, she was a dyke.
Mary Hayes, a.k.a. Molly Pitcher.
This is actually a pretty cool story. During the Revolutionary War, soldiers would often get very thirsty while fighting. That's where Mary Hayes came in, bravely carrying pitchers of water to the soldiers, running unarmed across the battlefield as bullets and shells whizzed by her. Once, during Pledge Week, the brothers made us carry thimbles full of our own urine across the quad while screaming faggots in our faces, so I know what she went through.
Sybil Ludington.
Finally, there's Sybil Ludington, who at 16 years old rode 40 miles around the town of Fredericksburg, New York, to alert local militia the British were coming. She's often called the female Paul Revere, although really, she rode twice as far as Paul Revere, so maybe he should be called the male Sybil Ludington. I'm just kidding, that would be totally gay. I found this story by accident during my routine Google search for 17-year-olds and horses. So, as it turns out, alongside the dozens of founding fathers whose words and deeds continue to reverberate throughout American society, there were, what, 4 or 5 women of note? Yeah, that sounds about right. All right, I'm out of here.
Would you mind if I told you how we do it in Canada? By Samantha Bee.
The story of America's independence from England is very well known, but did you know Canada was also once part of the British Empire? It's true. We Canadians threw off the same British yoke as you, only we took a more leisurely route to liberation. In fact, you might say we've been declaring our independence for more than 200 years. Kind of. Our style of revolution centered less on bloodshed and guerrilla warfare and more on the time-tested strategy of not making a fuss. For example, at the same time you were declaring war on the English monarchy, we were enjoying privileges granted to us by King George in the Treaty of Versailles, which gave us fishing rights off the coast of Newfoundland, provided we not dry or cure fish on land. And by the way, we later got the right to cure and dry fish on land, thank you very much. All I'm saying is there's more than one way to skin a cat. Not that I'm in any way saying I would like to harm a cat. Quite the contrary. I like cats. Unless America wants Canada to skin a cat, in which case we'll gladly do it. The point is, we took our time waiting for the Canadian moment to arrive rather than forcing it upon the world. We waited in the cold, watching the U.S., most of Central and South America, Africa, and Asia throw off its colonial oppressors. I think it was us in Belize that held out. And our patience ultimately paid off, for in the glorious year of 1982, we took the bold step of getting permission from England to amend our constitution so we could amend our constitution without getting permission from England. Let freedom ring! Now the only remnants of the tyrannical rule of Queen Elizabeth II are an appointed Governor General who represents her in Canadian governmental affairs. And the Queen is still officially our head of state. Plus, she's on all our money. And when we take a government job, we have to swear a loyalty pledge to her. All in all, a small price to pay for an independence achieved without bloodshed, violence, glory, or independence. I'm sorry if this in any way seems like I'm bragging.
Founding Father, Fact and Fiction.
In the horrific and unimaginable days before television, Americans learned about their public figures from stories passed along from person to person. Often these stories became myths, which then grew into legends, before reaching their final and most exalted status, outright lies. Let's take a look at some of these tales and separate fact from fiction.
The legend.
The young George Washington chops down a cherry tree, then famously confesses, "I cannot tell a lie. I did it."
What really happened?
Believe it or not, this myth is actually true. Washington was famously honest, even to the point of rudeness, as evidenced by his remark to Betsy Ross when she presented her first more avant-garde design for the American flag. Quote, "I cannot tell a lie, Betsy. Is that a flag or did your sewing kit throw up?"
The legend.
Paul Revere rides through the streets of Boston shouting, "The British are coming! The British are coming!"
What really happened?
Historians say Revere probably would not have been yelling, "The British are coming," since at the time, most colonists still thought of themselves as British. His actual cry was, "I say, representatives of the King's army will be arriving on our shores to do most grievous harm to us, their fellow subjects under the crown. So be mindful and watchful on this night." Over the course of his 12-mile gallop, he managed to complete the phrase 3 times.
The legend.
Alexander Hamilton was shot and killed in a duel with Aaron Burr.
What really happened?
Hamilton and Burr were actually best friends. One day they were rooting around in Burr's dad's house after school and found a pistol behind a stack of old girly pamphlets. Believing the pistol empty, Burr suggested they use it to play constables and rogues. Minutes later, the architect of American capitalism was mortally wounded.
The legend.
John Hancock signed the Declaration of Independence extra large because he wanted to be sure King George could read it.
What really happened?
John Hancock was 23 feet tall and merely signed in his normal fashion.
The legend.
Before his execution at the hands of British authorities, patriot Nathan Hale said, "I regret that I have but one life to give for my country."
What really happened?
Hale continued, "But what I really regret is that I'm giving it now." And then began the begging.
Discussion questions. 1. Why do you think the framers made the Constitution so soul-crushingly boring? 2. Have you ever founded anything? If so, is it something that went on to become a global superpower? If not, why not? 3. When, in the course of human events, is it necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands that connect it to another? Phrase your answer in the form of a declaration. 4. Look in the Constitution for an example of each of the following. A. A check or balance. B. A reference to black people as being worth exactly 3/5 of white people. C. The word erection. D. The part that keeps Arnold Schwarzenegger from becoming president. 5. Look in the Bill of Rights for the amendment that makes specific reference to each of the following. A. Affirmative action. B. Partial birth abortions. C. Yelling fire in a crowded theater. D. The homosexual agenda. E. Arnold Schwarzenegger can now run for president. 6. 13 colonies. That's bad luck. Who was the colony wizard who came up with that one? Chapter 3. The President, King of Democracy. In this chapter, you will learn that not everyone can be president, and why people should really stop spreading that rumor. Discover that most of what you've seen on The West Wing is total fucking bullshit. Find out where you fall in the line of succession. Be surprised to find out who our gayest president was. Lose your virginity. Maybe, if you play your cards right.
The lights dim. The voice of God is heard over the loudspeaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America.
The crowd leaps to its feet as the tall, handsome, slightly graying at the temples Ivy League graduate strides confidently to the dais, urged on by thunderous applause and the giddy strains of Hail to the Chief. Born the humble son of salt-of-the-earth quadriplegic immigrants, he has just been elected the most powerful man in the world. Yet, in just 4 to 8 years, you will be able to book him to speak in front of your Rotary Club or at a library opening. He will cost less than J-Lo. This is the magic of the presidency. Anyone can grow up to be president, but no one can stay. The President of the United States is the most powerful, most recognizable, and best person on earth. As commander-in-chief of the world's only remaining superpower, he wields enormous influence over global affairs. Indeed, if America is the world's policeman, the president is the gruff but lovable police chief in charge of enforcing the law from his comfortable perch above it. Domestically, the president's agenda provides the nation with its economic, social, and moral compass. Add to this a bewildering array of duties ranging from
giving to the Congress information of the State of the Union
to
feigning enthusiasm for the visiting NCAA women's basketball champions.
And you will still only begin to get a sense of the constitutionally mandated clusterfuck that is the modern presidency. The man who holds this most exalted office does so not by birthright, but by merit. This notion has inspired children throughout the nation to dream that one day, if they worked hard enough, they too could become president of the United States. And even though all but 43 of those children would see that dream die and thus be forced to find satisfaction in some bullshit low-level sales job a monkey could do, that's besides the point. We can all agree, dreaming is fun. But once in office, the president becomes acutely aware he is temporary steward of a permanent position. The 22nd Amendment, passed in the wake of the depression-ending World War II-winning nightmare that was the Roosevelt administration, means the president has no more than 8 years, and possibly as little as 1 month, to put his stamp on the office. Every day brings the president that much closer to the time he will turn on the TV to see someone else's face burned in effigy outside a foreign embassy. The moment, as you can imagine, is bittersweet. Inventing the presidency. Who's the boss? As outlined by the founders in Article 2 of the Constitution, the office of the presidency is a masterwork of political compromise. It was devised as a leadership position incorporating the benefits of a strong central authority figure, i.e. accountability and protection, while avoiding the pitfalls, i.e.
I now proclaim myself supreme leader of the United States of Myselvia. Commence with the killing of the redheads.
The president would be the nation's chief administrator, a powerful executive with command of the armed forces, bound by the rule of law to peacefully relinquish the job after his term. Room and board, a good salary, and license to rape and pillage were but a few perks of the office. Years later, he would get his own plane. By far the most revolutionary aspect of this new position would be who could hold it. The short answer, just about anyone. By placing no explicit race, gender, or religious requirement on the presidency, the founders opened the door to true meritocracy. Why no women, blacks, or non-Christians have answered the founders' challenge is a mystery, though most indications point to some inherent genetic flaw. William Howard Taft came closest, having what most observers agreed were boobs. The founders did see fit to place three small requirements on who could be president, technicalities, really. One, you must be a native citizen of the United States. Very important. Imagine having fought for years to win your independence from England, only to have King George get on the ballot and win. Very embarrassing. Two, you must have been 14 years a resident within the United States. Self-explanatory. 15 years is an inordinately long residence requirement to ask of candidates. And 13 years? Please, 13? Get fucking serious. Three, you must be at least 35 years old. Though one would think this was to ensure people seeking the office had the requisite experience and wisdom, in reality, the clause again safeguarded against tyranny. The average lifespan in colonial times was 41.3, so with 35 as the minimum, even a brutal tyrant would have only 5-7 years tops before gout, cholera, and/or syphilis redemocratized the nation. The only other criterion considered was height. The debate over this proposal consisted mostly of Thomas Jefferson holding a stick over James Madison's head and shouting,
"You must be this tall to be president."
The vote on the motion was ultimately postponed due to tears. Tiny, tiny tears. The modern presidency, the Oval Empire. Conceived as an executive with limited power, who needs the approval of Congress to so much as take a shit, the office of the presidency has expanded over time. While our first president, George Washington, summed up his initially modest expectations for the new job in a farewell address entitled, "I Only Took the Job for the Poontang," the last two centuries have seen the president's role in government grow tremendously. Indeed, over the past 50 years, the office has frequently been accused of overstepping the boundaries set forth for it in the Constitution. That's why many presidents think of the Constitution as, in the words of John Adams during 1798's signing of the Alien and Sedition Acts, quote, "a decent jumping-off point." National security. The president is commander-in-chief of the armed forces, a power vested in him whether he is a veteran of the military, Washington, Grant, Eisenhower, Kennedy, or Bush Sr., or a veteran of running away from the military, Clinton, Bush Jr. Though many presidents have been humbled by this responsibility, Washington famously cautioned against its use in foreign entanglements, others viewed it as a muscle needing exercise to avoid atrophy. President Ronald Reagan invaded Grenada, a country with a drink-bead-based economy. Control of the armed forces is arguably the most important power entrusted to the president. The Constitution keeps him from abusing it by making him unable to declare war without the expressed written consent of Congress and, if possible, Major League Baseball. This provision was intended to prevent what the framers called an impulse war. It is a foolproof check on the president's power, as the only way to circumvent it would be citing proof of an imminent threat to convince Congress to grant the president broader power through an ambiguously worded resolution, or if he called the war a police action, or if he didn't tell anybody. The president can also negotiate treaties, which is considered as vital a task as commanding the armed forces, but nowhere near as fun. Some presidents have proven abler negotiators than others. Both Franklin and Theodore Roosevelt showed themselves masters of the delicate art of diplomacy, while it was widely known Franklin Pierce couldn't treaty his way out of a paper bag. Legislative power. Though the president is very powerful, he cannot make laws. The president can suggest laws. The president can call individual congressmen and threaten, beg, and cajole them to make laws. The president can use the bully pulpit and appeal directly to the people to ask Congress to make laws. The president can promise that if these congressmen pass the laws the president likes, he will make them a delicious sandwich. The president can hold his breath and pound his fists and threaten to run away. But the president cannot make laws. The president can observe a vexing situation that seems to run counter to common sense, shake his head and say aloud, "There ought to be a law." But the president cannot make that law. The president cannot even write up that law and submit it with his name on it. The president needs someone in Congress to submit it for him. The president can only sit in his office and sign or not sign laws other people make. Sometimes this makes the president feel like a total pussy. Then the president realizes he is commander-in-chief of the armed forces and an island country is about to get a can of police action opened up on them. This usually makes the president feel better. Powers of appointment. Yet another power the president enjoys is that of appointment. Ambassadors, judges, members of his cabinet, you name them, he names them, said President Martin Van Buren of this power.
Thanks. That completely makes up for not being able to make laws.
Typically, cabinet appointments make up a new president's second order of business, right after calling up everyone he knows and passive-aggressively saying, what's new with me? I don't know, not much. Oh, I'm the President of the United States. Then comes the cabinet, which upon swearing in assumes the day-to-day functions of government so the president can go have fun. Presidents don't like to do very much work. The president usually obtains speedy congressional approval of his cabinet, unless he has a particularly contentious relationship with Congress. Then cabinet nominees are picked off one by one for various offenses, ranging from tax law technicality to rumored connections with white power, black power, or gayness. It is a process called vetting, and it keeps the cabinet from becoming dangerously skilled. Most members of a president's cabinet later admit the job was not worth the book deal. The president's next power of appointment concerns federal judgeships. Most such appointments occur at levels of the judiciary with which the public is unfamiliar. But sometimes, if a president is truly fortunate, a Supreme Court justice retires or dies on his watch. This gives the president a chance to appoint to a lifetime term on the highest court in the land, the craziest motherfucker he can sneak past Congress. Typically, these appointees are jurists whose opinions run the ideological gamut from the right.
Jesus says retarded gays must be put to death.
To the left.
Man on pumpkin sex is an inalienable right and should be taught to children.
Any Supreme Court nominee whose opinion falls in between is deemed ideologically unreliable, and his nomination is killed in committee. As for ambassadors, they are widely considered the least important of the presidential appointments. In the 228 years since the founding of the nation, no one has ever asked what they are doing. Often, the president will even write the names of potential ambassadors on scraps of paper and let his dog pick out where they are going, just to keep things fun. Ambassadors tend to be donors and friends of the president, who subsequently receive assignments in exotic locales with few, if any, sexual taboos. Run afoul of the chief executive, however, and you can also receive an ambassadorship. These posts are less desirable and often require vaccinations. A 4-year stint as charge d'affaires in Lower Ascracklevania usually resolves any issue the president may have had with you. Miscellaneous duties, perks. The office does entail a few other privileges and tasks worth noting. Every first Monday of the month, the president must bring donuts to the cabinet meeting. The president receives season tickets to all San Jose Sharks home games, including the playoffs. The president can have gay sex on the down low and still not be gay. When ordering Mexican, the president gets free guac. Whenever he wants, the president can go to the White House kitchen and eat all the chocolate out of the Neapolitan ice cream, leaving only vanilla and strawberry. The president must begin every sentence with the words, "My fellow Americans," or it doesn't count. And for his first year in office, the president is required to drop and give 20 push-ups whenever any previous president demands it. The president has full access to the West Wing jacuzzi, but must turn his key at the same time as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to activate the air jets. The president can have his pick of up to, but no more than, 7 of People magazine's 50 most beautiful people. So there you have it. The history of the presidency is a history of growth and expansion directly mirroring that of the United States itself. Even as visionary a group as the Founding Fathers could not have foreseen the office evolving from its modest goal of national manager to leader of the free world. But that's just what the gig has become. Today's president is loved and hated the world over. Even the stupidest schoolchildren can name him, while the nerdiest can name all of them in less than 30 seconds. Presidents have been assassinated, lionized, impeached, mocked, shaved, and filleted. Like it or not, more so than any other figure in our nation, the president embodies America. And one day, you could be him. But not really.
Supplemental material. The Vice President, a heartbeat away from relevance.
One of the White House's most enduring traditions is the Vice Presidential Welcome Letter, left in the Vice President's desk by each administration's outgoing second-in-command. Its purpose? To explain to the new Vice President exactly what it is he or she will be doing over the next 4 to 8 years. It is published for the first time ever here. Dear Vice President Blank, if you are reading this letter, you've just been elected Vice President. That means your most vital job is already done, namely balancing the ticket. Congratulations on being from a region geographically disparate from that of the President. Well done. Now begins your term of duty. The hard work is about to begin. Are you sitting down? Good. That's it. Is there a clock nearby? Look at it. You will come to know it well, for its glacially turning second hand marks the excruciating march to the end of your meaningless days in this office. Don't get too comfortable. Constitutionally speaking, you are the President of the Senate, and may therefore be called upon to cast a tie-breaking Senate vote. Don't worry, though, it probably won't happen, and if they need you, they'll call. So that's about it. The liquor cabinet is usually fully stocked. Go ahead, fix yourself a stiff one. There's no reason why you shouldn't spend the better part of your days in a drunken stupor. Just remember, shave for the State of the Union. You have to sit behind the President for that one. Good luck. P.S. One other thing, you must be prepared to take over at a moment's notice if the Commander-in-Chief should be unable to serve. Just a heads up there.
Warren G. Harding, Our Worst President, by Stephen Colbert. Historians debate feverishly over who is the best president in American history. However, there is little disagreement over who was the worst. His name was Warren G. Harding, and he sucked. The reasons why he sucked are many, and, to be truthful, have been widely cataloged in the annals of presidential history. So, with your indulgence, I'd like to focus instead on the intensity of his sucking. Warren G. Harding was a worthless piece of shit. Fuck him. His presidency was a taint, not just in the sense of a stain on the office, but literally a taint, the anatomical area between the anus and the testicles. I hate Warren G. Harding. Stephen Colbert is the Arthur Schlesinger Professor of American Studies at Harvard University. The Cabinet, Yes Men of Freedom.
No president can execute his agenda alone, though James K. Polk tried and it nearly killed him after 13 days. Instead, the president assembles a crack team of racially and ethnically diverse experts to head up various departments within the federal bureaucracy. They are collectively known as the Cabinet, so naturally they sit around a giant conference table.
Secretary of Treasury.
Duties primarily concerned with, but not necessarily all about, the Benjamins.
Secretary of Defense.
During diplomatic crises, initiates chant of fight, fight, fight. Also in charge of kicking sand in face of Secretary of State.
Secretary of Transportation.
Driven a car before? Seen an airplane? Hispanic? Good, put on this tie.
National Security Advisor.
Advises President on National Security. Pretty straightforward, really.
Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Regulates Food and Drug Administration, which is responsible for second half of prescription drug commercials, the parts about nausea and diarrhea. Good place to plug in another minority.
Secretary of Agriculture.
Monitors safety and quality of meat, eggs, and poultry. After that, it gets a little boring.
Secretary of Education.
Charged with keeping our educational system among the world's best, using the budgetary equivalent of one F-16 Tomahawk fighter jet. Often corrects other cabinet members with the phrase, "You mean the President and I."
Secretary of the Interior.
In charge of the nation's rich inner life, divisions under his or her calm, watchful gaze, the Bureau of Contemplation and Federal Office of Feelings Management, also responsible for dismantling national park system.
Secretary of Energy.
Responsible for getting this party started. leads cabinet in cheers, trust exercises, and rainy day games. Never shows up without Jock Jams Volume 1 CD.
Director of Homeland Security.
Came up with color-coded terror chart in 2002. Hasn't done jack shit since.
Secretary of State.
Shakes hands with important people. Then attempts to get those people to shake hands with each other. Applicants must supply their own American flag lapel pin. Must also learn phrase, please, Your Excellency. The President didn't mean that in 125 different languages.
Attorney General.
Nation's top law enforcement official. Directly oversees bungled shootouts, standoffs gone amok. Also curious about what you've checked out of the library. Understanding Islam. How interesting.
If I Were President, by Ed Helms.
My fellow Americans, if I, Ed Helms, were president, I would serve the country I love by making things better, not worse. For instance, health insurance. I believe every American should have health insurance. So I would write a law giving it to them. And then I'd sign it right away. I also don't think people should have to struggle to make ends meet. So I would fix the economy. Now, it's no secret the Israeli-Palestinian crisis has been going on for months. I would get them together and let them talk. Why hasn't anyone done that yet? Sometimes the simplest solution is the best one. The president is also the nation's moral leader. I don't really know how I'd play this one. If I were president, I would end the unfair taxation on tax the people already pay. It's called double taxation, and it's totally unfair. Right now, Uncle Sam collects 35 cents on every dollar I make. I'd change the law so I could write that off and only pay tax on the remaining 65 cents. At a 35% rate, that would leave me with 42 cents. Okay, wait, that's actually less. I worked this out the other day. Can I get back to you on the tax thing? Great. And what's the Department of Labor for? Here's a shocking fact I once heard. No one knows. If I were president, it would be gone. Unless there's something I'm not seeing here. Also, I would order the immediate death of Roger Simpson, the one who lives at 1310 North 7th Avenue, apartment 12A, Oroville, California. He knows why! Okay, that about does it. Oh, one more thing. In a Helms administration, Air Force One would officially be renamed Air Force Fun. I feel very strongly about this.
Ed Helms was the Prime Minister of New Zealand from 1994 to 96. Presidential nicknames.
In light of their unlimited power, it's easy to forget that many presidents are human beings. So Americans like to bestow monikers on their commanders-in-chief to feel like they know them, even though in reality the president has a veritable army of people to keep regular Americans the hell away from him. But where do these familiar or nicknames come from?
Tricky Dick.
Richard Nixon was regarded as an agile and tricky political opponent. Also, he was a dick.
Mr. Norris.
Millard Fillmore, our 13th president, lived for 18 years with a pair of magical talking cats, who, for reasons known only to them, insisted on calling their human master, Mr. Norris. Denise, the female of the pair, was also influential in the foreign policy of the Fillmore administration, a period later dubbed by historians as the era of the president who was batshit insane.
The Great Emancipator.
Contrary to popular belief, Abraham Lincoln's nickname had nothing to do with the Emancipation Proclamation he signed in 1863. Rather, the name was given to him by high school classmates, who took note of the gangly teen's penchant for getting stuck in and then extricating himself from difficult situations and spaces.
Silent Cal.
Calvin Coolidge still ranks as the quietest president of all time. Famously, a woman once approached him saying, "I bet my friend I could get you to say more than two words," to which Coolidge wittily replied, "Fuck you."
The Gipper.
Though noted for his status as a conservative ideologue and effective communicator, Ronald Reagan was perhaps best known for his constant and exuberant gipping.
Discussion questions. 1.
Who was your favorite president? 2. Why? 3. Surely somebody can name their favorite president. 4. Okay, how about any president? No. 5. Come on, people. We just did an entire unit on this. 6. No one in this class can name one single president. 7. Fuck it, man. Does anybody have a light? Classroom activities. 1. Give each student a blue index card with the word veto written on it. Explain that this may be redeemed to prevent any one classroom event, a quiz, a reading assignment, from happening. See how much shit gets done in the next month. 2. Determine a succession plan should your teacher be assassinated. 3. Have the entire class write to the president in the style of letters to Penthouse Forum. Make sure each letter commences with the phrase, I never thought this would happen to me, but... 4. Make the Ford administration come alive by making your very own WIN, Whip Inflation Now, buttons. Chapter 4. Congress. Quagmire of Freedom. In this chapter, you will gain new appreciation for rotundas. Compare and contrast the soulless, gray-faced bureaucrats of the Senate with the soulless, gray-faced bureaucrats of the House. Embark on an exotic journey of the senses as you are exposed as a leftist and homosexual by Senator Joseph McCarthy. Meet and immediately dislike lobbyists. Learn how to hide your purchase of this audiobook in a much larger book appropriations bill.
If the president is the head of the American body politic, Congress is its gastrointestinal tract. Its vast and convoluted inner workings may be mysterious and unpleasant, but in the end, they excrete a great deal of material whose successful passage is crucial to our nation's survival. This is Congress's duty. To understand the need for a legislative branch in a democracy, we must first acknowledge two central truths. 1. Society needs laws. While anarchy can often turn a humdrum weekend into something unforgettable, eventually the mob must be kept from stealing the conch and killing Piggy. And while it would be nice if that something was simple human decency, anybody who has witnessed the 50% off wedding dress sale at Filene's basement knows we need a backup plan. Preferably in writing. On the other hand, too many laws can result in outright tyranny, particularly if one of those laws is kneel before Zod. Somewhere between these two extremes lies the legislative sweet spot that produces just the right amount of laws for a well-adjusted society, more than zero, less than fascism. 2. People are busy.
Gee, guys, I'd love to help you make some laws today, but the in-laws are coming this weekend, and Jenny's gonna kill me if I don't clean my shit out of the guest bedroom. Uh-huh. Look, I'm sorry. I know this is an important appropriations bill, but I'm telling you, she's still pissed at me for... Well, fine. Don't set aside monies for municipal improvements in District 12. See if I give a fuck.
A dedicated legislative branch is comprised of representatives to do the people's work, giving citizens the freedom to pursue their own lives while still enjoying the benefits of a lawful society, even if they are too whipped to see it. But once empowered, what keeps the legislative body from becoming morbidly obese? Once again, our Constitution provides the healthy diet of checks and balances that keep our government from appearing on the local news, being removed from its bedroom by a crane. Unlike the president with his fancy-pants electors, the Constitution requires congressmen to be directly elected by regular-pantsed citizens. Thus, more than any other branch of government, Congress must heed the will of the people. The astute listener may rightly wonder,
but didn't you just say the people were busy?
Touché. This minor glitch in our representative government is rectified by the white knights of democracy, corporations. These altruistic entities hire lobbyists, whose sole job is to ensure through persuasive argument and financial remuneration that Congress never forgets the people's wishes, especially the people's wishes for deregulation. This model of direct elections by the people for representatives of a lawmaking body to be overseen by corporate lobbyists with obscene amounts of cash has proven so efficient that 96% of congressmen are reelected. Clearly the system is working. Why else would the same officials be elected over and over and over again? Voter apathy? Entrenchment born of a corrupt system designed to ensure those in power stay in power? Tell it to Castro, Paco. Congress and its remora, the lobbyists, allow Americans to enjoy the benefits of a lawful and functioning society while only having to think about it once every 2 to 4 years, if at all. Once again, the Founding Fathers are in line for a shout-out. The Making of Congress, Hot Bicameral Action. When the Founders sat down to create this new civil order, they had two central truths in mind. One, representative democracy would be the most stable and lasting form of government. Two, when the Constitutional Convention wrapped up, they were all going to be out of work. The latter led to the formulation of what historians would come to know as the Madison Hypothesis. The diminutive Virginian opined,
"What if we created a national legislature copious enough in membership and curious enough in structure as to provide the whole of us with a gig for life?"
added James Otis of Massachusetts.
"Verily, should not the designers of this government also be the stewards?"
said Barzini, a legitimate craftsman from Rhode Island.
"We deserve a taste. In sooth, we should be able to dip our beaks, know what I'm saying?"
Barzini then moved that New Jersey's John Witherspoon be kissed on the lips, signaling Witherspoon was now dead to him. That motion died in committee, but the larger point was agreed upon. With the Founders' employment now secured, it was time to address specifics. What formula would determine the makeup of this legislature? Should the criterion be population, with every person equally represented? Or should every state be equally represented? Should black people still count as 3/5? Isn't even 5/16 pushing it? Is it wise to found a new country using fractions at all? And is Franklin serious when he says, "No fat chicks"? If representation was calculated by person, states like Rhode Island or Delaware would be routinely voted down by the more populous New York and Virginia. That would be unfair. But if each state had the same number of representatives, states like Rhode Island and Delaware would have the exact same say as New York and Virginia. That would be unfair as well. And speaking of unfair, are those Indians going to be staring at us the whole time we're figuring this out? The solution? Determining representation by a complex equation involving total weight of the populace divided by virgins per square mile. Or so it might have been, had not a last-minute solution of Solomonic wisdom emerged. The baby legislature would be cut in half, creating a unique bicameral structure consisting of two distinct chambers, the Senate, or Upper House, and House of Representatives, or Lower House. One late-night session led the Founders to consider the addition of a third chamber, or Waffle House, though by morning most agreed the idea, seemingly so brilliant at 3 a.m., now seems stupid. The House of Representatives would be the larger chamber and would directly reflect the nation's diversity. A state's number of representatives would be based on its population, and its members would face re-election every 2 years. These rules established the House as Congress's rough-and-tumble populist forum. Though a case could be made, it merely created a haven for ideological whack jobs with job security issues. By contrast, the more deliberative Senate would be comprised of 2 men from each state, regardless of size or population. Its members would be richer, better groomed, smarter, their wives hotter. Passing senators would be greeted with respectful salutes and pleasantries such as,
"Hello, Governor."
And,
"Quite a day for a stroll, no?"
Worlds away from the accepted House greetings of,
"Shoo, shoo, shoo."
And,
"Are there congressmen about, or is someone eating a shit sandwich?"
Senators would also only face re-election every 6 years, as it was widely acknowledged they were 3 times better than congressmen. The 2 chambers would be run, respectively, by the Speaker of the House and the Senate President Pro Tem, a Latin phrase meaning, "for the Tem," Each chamber would have its own officers, majority and minority leaders, whips, and sergeant-at-arms. The House would select one member each month as Employee of the Month. The Senate would hold an annual canned food drive. The senator who brought the most cans would receive a 10-speed. There would be interchamber dances and spirit rallies. Wednesdays, ladies would drink free. The Speaker of the House would also be third in line for the presidency, though as many an ambitious speaker has noted, it's not a very fast-moving line. The sausage of governance, how laws are made. The size and makeup of Congress having been decided, it was time to lawmake. Now, the process of creating and enacting legislation is far too complicated to be covered in a book, even this book, which is ostensibly written by experts and dedicated to doing just that. Interested listeners should refer to the definitive work on the subject, Schoolhouse Rock, for a more detailed, catchier treatment. But, put very briefly, a piece of proposed legislation is known as a bill. Each year, members of Congress sponsor thousands of bills, or at the very least, scribble their names onto other people's bills for partial credit. These bills then become laws. Or not. Of course, that's not the entire story. After a bill's sponsors have tweaked and massaged it to their liking, the bill heads to the appropriate committee, like the Appropriations Committee. That's a good committee. Bills dealing with national security are sent to the Intelligence Committee. Economic policy bills head to the Treasury Committee, while the itty-bitty-titty committee sits and waits for bills that never come. Committees are where members of both parties consider the bill and then mark it up with additions, deletions, and haikus. The Senate Appropriations Committee, or the House Ways and Means Committee, also review most bills. These committees are concerned with the financial implications of each bill and generally compete in a game to see which chamber has the balls to drive the national debt higher. It's called deficit chicken, and it's even more fun when you're drunk. Once out of committee, a bill then travels to the floor for a process known as floor action, which is 70% to 75% less hot than it sounds. The bill's backers are given the floor to describe its benefits, while the bill's critics are expected to sit quietly and limit dissent to eye rolls and muffled "homo says what's." Increasingly, debaters make their points with C-SPAN's two cameras in mind, leading to a dramatic growth in the use of misleading charts. All legislative speeches and documents are then entered word for word into the congressional record to preserve the nation's wealth of pompous bullshit for future generations. Once a bill has been widely debated and minds have been made up as to its efficacy, it's amendment sneaking time. For example, a representative might take an important $2 billion airline security bill on the verge of passage and attach a $75 million rider appropriating funds for his home district to build an interactive corn museum. In the lingo of Washington, such magnanimous expenditure is known as pork. You might think the phrase derives from the piggish greed its practitioners display by subverting fiscal responsibility in the name of self-interest, but in reality, it's a harmless reference to the benign plantation practice of distributing rations of salt pork to slaves from wooden barrels. Once one House approves a bill, it is referred to the other, which repeats the committee debating vote process. The two chambers then reconcile their versions of the bill in one last round of gutless compromise and underhanded patronage. The bill is now ready to be sent to the lobbyists. For if a bill is finally going to become law, it's going to have to pass lobbyist muster. At rates of only $300 to $500 an hour, these professionally concerned private citizens can assist our representatives in any last-minute changes in language or content or intent necessary to ensure their re-election funds. Lobbyists even help expedite legislation by touting its benefits to members whose votes are needed. In many ways, lobbyists are the cheerleaders of Capitol Hill. Sad, soulless, clandestine, unfuckable cheerleaders. Now that the statute no longer forbids dumping mercury into kiddie pools, the bill has passed lobbyist muster and is ready for the president's signature. Arduous? Yes, but it's this magical process of lawmaking that helps turn
"thou shalt not kill"
into
Within the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States, any unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought, perpetrated by persons lying in wait, or any other kind of willful, deliberate, malicious, and premeditated killing, or committed in the perpetration of an attempt to perpetrate any arson, escape, murder, kidnapping, treason, espionage, sabotage, aggrieved sexual assault, or burglary, or robbery, or perpetrated from a premeditated design unlawfully and maliciously to effect the death of any human being other than him who is killed, is murder in the first degree.
The Modern Congress, representing. Lawmaking is tedious and never-ending. If not for the good salary and godlike sense of ultimate power, it would hardly seem worth it. But lawmaking is not the only power the Constitution grants Congress. Article 1, Section 8 also imbues in Congress the power to levy and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay debts. Congress also acts as a check and balance on the government's other branches. Congress has the final approval over presidential appointments, to say nothing of treaties and the ultimate ability to declare war. Add to that the congressional responsibilities for weights and measures, raising and maintaining militias and navies, punishing piracy and printing money, and it's no wonder these workhorses are in session almost a full 120 days of any given year. Yes, when not running for re-election or raising money to run for re-election or spending money in the interest of their re-election, Congress is doing the people's business. Sometimes congressmen even return to their districts and states to rap with the people. This practice is excruciatingly awkward for both sides. But remember, Congress is us, and we are Congress. Our representatives are men and women drawn from all echelons of American society. Lawyers, doctors, former athletes, lawyers again, businessmen, moguls, magnates, poobahs, VIPs, and gopher from the Love Boat. Why do they serve? Some are moved by the words of the late John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Others, by the amount of tail that kind of talk used to get the late president. Still others entertain Mephistophelian visions of unlimited power over the affairs of men. Ultimately, though, all are active participants in the lawmaking body that forms the bedrock of our republic. They give voice to the nation's millions, and through legislation, shape the way we live. Indeed, the rules mandated by Congress define our very society and, in a larger sense, who we are as a people. And that is why pot is still illegal.
Would you mind if I told you how we do it in Canada? By Samantha Bee.
Hi again. Sorry, I know you're probably really busy with the rest of the audiobook and everything, but you know, in Canada, we have something sort of similar to Congress, only with far more in the way of ceremonial weaponry. We call it Parliament, and it has two chambers, just like your Congress. But instead of electing both houses, we let a representative of the Queen appoint the Senate. And we've been meaning to say something about that for the last 150 years, but the right moment hasn't come up. On the other hand, the House of Commons is directly elected by the populace. Well, kind of. Actually, we have to vote for parties instead of individuals. Only instead of just two major parties, we have four. I guess you could say Canadians are party animals. Sorry. Politically speaking, having so many parties makes it harder for anyone to get a majority, and thus, to get anything done. But when we really need to break a logjam, it's technically possible for a party to win control of Parliament without getting the most votes. Here, let me explain how. First, your party needs at least a plurality in sparsely populated ridings, or what you would call...
The preceding section has been deleted due to extreme boringness.
So that's cool. Oh, and one other neat thing about Canada. All governmental business is conducted in both French and English, because a small minority of Canadians, called Québécois, never wanted to learn English, and we thought it was rude to ask them to. But the good news is everyone in Canada has to learn French. Though, actually, it's not really French. It's a regional patois that actual French people despise. So there's that. My point is, when you think about it, Congress and Parliament aren't that different at all. Or are they? I don't mean to be presumptuous. Again, sorry to interrupt.
The five interesting moments in Senate history. The burning of the Capitol, August 24th, 1814.
During the War of 1812, British troops occupy Washington, D.C., setting numerous government buildings on fire, including the Capitol. The conflagration prompted a 5-hour congressional debate over whether to evacuate the building or burn to death. Ultimately, the Senate voted 21-19 along strict party lines to run for their lives, but only after attaching a rider appropriating additional funds for fort construction in the Oregon Territory.
The caning of Senator Charles Sumner, May 22, 1856.
In retribution for a speech insulting Southerners for their pro-slavery views, South Carolina Representative Preston Brooks beat Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner with a metal-topped cane in the Senate chamber. Though rendered unconscious, Sumner miraculously arose and retaliated with his trademark Sumner Triple Suplex, thereby retaining the Senate Wrestling Federation championship belt.
The arrival of Senator Mr. Smith, October 17, 1939.
Capitol Hill was turned on its ear by the arrival of Jefferson Smith, a wide-eyed, idealistic junior senator whose unerring moral compass inspired his colleagues to reevaluate their attitudes towards democracy and the American spirit. Smith was later revealed to be not an actual senator, but rather actor Jimmy Stewart performing in the film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. The resulting disillusionment triggered an onset of national cynicism from which America has never recovered. Years later, Eddie Murphy remade the film as Here Come Mr. Smith.
The Army-McCarthy hearings begin April 22, 1954.
The Red Scare reached a climax during Senator Joseph McCarthy's televised subcommittee hearings when Army lawyer Joseph Welch famously asked McCarthy, "Have you no sense of decency, sir?" McCarthy less famously responded, "Indeed I do, sir, only I seem to have left it on your mother's nightstand." And then they broke out the whiffle canes.
The Strom-Thurmond filibuster, August 28, 1957.
Senator Strom Thurmond, Republican South Carolina, set the record for longest filibuster with his 24-hour, 18-minute speech railing against a civil rights bill. The marathon speaking session left Thurmond so drained he could barely have sex with the underaged black woman in his family's employ. Thurmond's oration obliterated the previous filibuster record, a 13-hour description by Daniel Webster of the massive dump he had just taken.
Discussion questions. 1. If con is the opposite of pro, then isn't Congress the opposite of progress? Or did we just fucking blow your mind? 2. What does bicameral mean? Are any of the girls in your class bicameral? 3. Which would you rather see getting made, sausage or laws? 4. In Star Wars Episode 2, Chancellor Palpatine convinces the Galactic Senate to grant him emergency powers in order to squelch the Separatist movement's droid army, led by Count Dooku. But Palpatine ultimately abuses his authority, disbanding the Republic and appointing himself the lone ruler of a new galactic empire. Could it happen here? 5. How are you enjoying this program so far? Be honest. 6. Remember that old Schoolhouse Rock cartoon about the Bill who sings a song about how he becomes a law? Hey, and what about the Snorks? Remember them? Classroom activities. 1. Take construction paper, trace your hand, and make a turkey of Congress. 2. Ask your students to choreograph an interpretive dance or compose a tone poem that represents the spirit of their favorite piece of legislation currently under consideration by a Senate subcommittee. 3. Find out each representative's porn name by adding the name of the largest city in their district to the name of their state flower. Example, Ben Chandler, Democrat, Kentucky, is Frankfurt Goldenrod. 4. Help the children make their own mace, the ebony and silver rod on the House rostrum symbolizing the authority of the House, out of paper towel rolls and elbow macaroni. Explain to the children they have just made useless representations of something that is itself useless and symbolic. Shame them. 5. Have fun with the gerrymander. Take 5 congressional districts in rural Texas that have experienced a sudden upswing in minority population. Using only 3 straight lines,
can you redraw the boundaries to consolidate white power in 4 of the 5 districts? If you can, please contact the office of Representative Tom DeLay, Republican, Texas. Chapter 5. The Judicial Branch. It Rules. In this chapter, you will desegregate a school. Take this audiobook all the way to the Supreme Court. Learn how to operate a gavel responsibly and safely. Discover how to know pornography when you see it.
Having discussed the executive and legislative, we arrive now at the judicial branch. The judicial branch is charged with interpreting the Constitution, and in any discussion of the United States government is always mentioned last. There is no shame in that. The judicial branch is up against some very strong branches. Who wouldn't want to be president? Even Congress, with lawmaking powers and a short work year, has a certain elegant simplicity and glamorous appeal. That is not to insinuate people feel the judicial branch is an unimportant part of our government, just that it is the least important. And this is exactly how the judicial branch likes it. Flying under most people's radar allows the judicial branch to quietly control all aspects of your life. From your morning hardcore pornography masturbation session, to your lunchtime abortion, right up through your twilight neo-Nazi march through a predominantly Jewish or black community, the judicial branch is there to make sure everything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, under God. If, as mentioned way back in Chapter 2, the Constitution is the nation's owner's manual, then your judicial branch is America's helpful 24-hour tech support, always available to explain how things should work. And like any good tech support, it costs extra, takes forever to reach, and you don't understand their instructions half the time anyway. At the top of the judicial branch is the Supreme Court. Unelected by the people, its proceedings are not televised. Justices rarely comment publicly or give on-the-record interviews. Not one has ever appeared on Leno. It may seem odd, undemocratic even, that a small group of unelected individuals can shape public policy far from the public's eye. But the court's peculiar insularity is by design. The justices' rarefied position provides them with a buffer from the winds of public sentiment and the demands of political expediency. They are thus free to base decisions entirely upon their interpretation of the Constitution. Interestingly, the interpretation of the word interpretation has itself evolved over the years and now means the political beliefs of whoever appointed you. Below the Supreme Court, district and federal appellate courts form an elaborately structured hierarchy of justice, so vast and multi-layered, it is quite possible you can be found innocent and guilty at the same time and be named a bankruptcy court judge in the bargain. So who are the people who make up the judicial branch? Why are they vested with the authority to interpret law? And just who the fuck do they think they are? These questions and more will be answered as we examine the origins of the judiciary and peek beneath the robes of the men and women who serve there, deepening our constitutional understanding and maybe, just maybe, getting a glimpse of their genitals. The justices. Who are they to judge? The highest court in the land is called the Supreme Court, proving that while justice may be blind, there's nothing wrong with her ego. And though the moniker may seem more appropriate for an omnipotent group of superheroes than 9 withered octogenarians, a position on the court is very prestigious. The process for selecting Chief Justice and 8 associate justices is complex, as each receives a lifetime appointment. A justice only leaves the bench via retirement, incapacitation, or removal by impeachment. They cannot be fired, laid off, downsized, or outsourced. Additionally, the only way to kill or wound a justice is with a diamond-tipped bullet from the anvil of Hephaestus. The president is responsible for nominating candidates to the Supreme Court. When selecting a nominee, presidents take into account a wide range of criteria, a lifetime of public service and scholarship, a thorough understanding of the day's political and social climate, and perhaps most importantly, minority status equal to or greater than the court member being replaced. The federally recognized value hierarchy is as follows.
White man is less than white woman is less than black or Latino man is less than black or Latino woman is less than any Eskimo.
Diversity has become a consideration because for the first 160 years of its existence, America's highest judicial body was comprised exclusively of white males. Then, in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson made Thurgood Marshall the Jackie Robinson of the Supreme Court. Marshall went on to bat 312 and steal 45 bases as he led the 65 court to the National League pennant. Sadly, the court lost the World Series 4-2 to the Detroit Tigers. Today, the court has achieved a moderate level of diversity with 2 women, 1 African American, and 1 homosexual. Guess. Ultimately, it is left to the president's discretion to choose a nominee. And whether he selects a good friend or merely a longtime acquaintance, a president must ask himself one critical question. Will this person only make decisions I agree with? Once nominated, a candidate goes through a confirmation process overseen by the Senate. In recent years, this process has grown noticeably politicized, with Judiciary Committee members attempting to learn in advance how a nominee might rule on a variety of hot-button issues. These are called litmus tests, because abortion tests sounds creepy. The judicial philosophies held by the 9 justices go a long way towards determining the decisions they hand down. For our purposes, these philosophies can be casually oversimplified into 2 main categories. 1. A judicial activist sees the Constitution as a living document that can be adapted and reinterpreted to protect the needs of a changing society, such as marriage between sodomites and impulse abortions. 2. A strict constructionist interprets the Constitution according to the language and original intent of the text at the time of its writing, in much the same way as a fundamentalist views the Bible. Fortunately for strict constructionists, they have been endowed by God with the superhuman gift of being able to read the minds of people who died 200 years ago. Naturally, they use this power only for good. A court is very often a reflection of its chief justice. For example, the Warren Court, under Chief Justice Earl Warren, is remembered for taking activist stances in cases involving civil rights. Its landmark decisions include Brown v. Board of Education, 1954, and Miranda v. Arizona, 1966, names that, even today, most high school students can easily recall for testing purposes. In contrast, the mid-19th century Taney Court, under Chief Justice Roger Taney, slanted more conservative, perhaps because it leaned towards states' rights. Or maybe it was their slaves that gave it away. Said Taney famously,
"What? These robes aren't going to clean themselves."
The Taft Court, under Chief Justice William Taft, 1921 to 1930, was known for its indecisiveness. In 10 years, the Taft Court rendered only one decision, finding for it in the case Eeny v. Meeny. How do you get to the Supreme Court? Practice law, practice law, practice law. How does the Supreme Court decide what cases to hear? Clearly, it cannot come running every time a fat guy sues a hamburger joint. Do you think they have that much time on their hands? They do not. Do you think the court is loafing? There is already a pending lawsuit regarding your careless accusations. They are but 9 feeble old people up against Americans, the most litigious people in the history of the planet. No, the Supreme Court only gets involved in the most difficult, important, and seminal cases. And if you are fortunate enough to find yourself in an intractable and tragic situation, you too could join the exalted ranks of a Roe, Miranda, or Nixon. But before you get there, you must travel a long and perilous legal trail. Bring Gorp. Enter the lower courts. Seriously, enter the lower courts. These exist to ease the burden on the Supreme Court, to lessen the load on their fragile, osteoporotic, uncomfortably hunched backs. These courts are called lower courts because they're lower, or worse. It all starts with the U.S. District Courts, the first stop whenever someone decides to make a federal case of something. Judges in these courts can barely read, and instead of gavels, bang their thick skulls against their desks to bring the court to order. It is not unusual for a district court judge to throw his sandwich at a lawyer he dislikes. Thus, it is no surprise many cases brought before district courts are unsatisfactorily resolved. These cases move to the next step, the U.S. Court of Appeals, a.k.a. the Court of the Sore Loser. There are 11 U.S. Courts of Appeal, and while not the highest court in the land, it is considered the most sarcastic. Requests to these courts are met with, "Wow, great motion. You must have gone to a really good law school." Finally, if a litigant feels he did not get the result he desired from the huge dicks on the appeals courts, it is on to the Supreme Court. If, and this is a big if, the Supreme Court feels like it. For the court to take on a case, at least 4 of the 9 justices must agree to hear it. Lawyers discover whether or not their case made the court's docket when they show up and start making their arguments. If the court has decided not to hear them, the justices turn to one another and say in an exaggeratedly theatrical manner, "Do you hear something? I thought I heard something. It must be flies buzzing around or something. La, 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 la." Arguing your case. Let it plead. Oral argument before the Supreme Court is limited to a half hour per side. While this may seem short, it is generally assumed the court has familiarized itself with the details of the cases. Also, David Souter has the attention span of a goldfish. Lights on the court's lectern warn lawyers when their half hour is almost up. A white light means a lawyer has only 5 minutes left, while a red light indicates his time is up, and he may only complete the sentence he is saying. A blue light indicates there is a special in aisle 7. Sometimes these specials offer litigants up to 50% off future writs. After hearing oral arguments, each justice retires to chambers to formulate a decision based upon his or her interpretation of the Constitution, or in the case of Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia's interpretation of the Constitution. The majority then writes its decision. Justices who disagree are free to issue dissenting opinions, which have no legal bearing, but serve as a nice on-the-record fuck you to the other justices. It is as simple and profound as that. Once the justices issue a decision, their word becomes law of the land. Schools are desegregated, abortions legalized, penises inserted into the anuses of our choosing. These 9 wise men and women, guided only by their consciences, their study of law, their political affiliations, their obedience to the president who appointed them, their personal distaste for the litigants before them, their accumulated lifetimes of prejudices and preferences, mood swings, affections and animosities toward their fellow justices, and of course, the occasional coin toss, make fundamental changes to the function and interpretation of the Constitution. The matter that has come before them is settled for good. Until, of course, a justice dies or retires and is replaced by a new appointee. At that point, all legal matters are once again subject to review. The 5-4 ruling of yesterday becomes the 4-5 ruling of tomorrow. And what do you know? It's back into the closet with the butt sex.
Supplemental material. Landmark Supreme Court cases.
Though the Supreme Court decides dozens of cases each year, only a handful of decisions are familiar to the general public. Here are a few of these landmark decisions.
Marbury v. Madison, 1803.
Established the principle of judicial review, that the Supreme Court has the power to declare laws unconstitutional. Before that, the court only had the power to check laws for spelling and punctuation.
Dred Scott, 1857.
The court finds that Dred Scott, a fugitive slave, is not a person, but property, and therefore is entitled neither to file suit in a federal court nor remain free in the North. Not the verdict Scott was hoping for. Historians agree the court battle sapped him, and when he went back to being a slave, his heart just wasn't in it.
Plessy v. Ferguson, 1896.
The court upholds segregation and the constitutionality of the separate but equal doctrine. The ruling was intended only to keep Plessy, a notorious womanizer, away from Ferguson, whose wife was quite comely. However, in one of the wackiest mishaps in judicial history, it was used to keep an entire race of people down for half a century.
Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, 1954.
Again with the black people, only this time there's a twist.
the court overturned the Plessy ruling, declaring the establishment of separate public schools for black and white students inherently unequal. This landmark verdict paved the way for integration, the civil rights movement, and the Beastie Boys.
Miranda versus Arizona, 1966.
The court rules suspects must be informed of their legal rights upon arrest. The resulting Miranda warning safeguards defendants from abuse and self-incrimination. It also requires the two police officers handling a suspect's interrogation adopt diametrically opposed attitudes toward that subject, with one taking a more benevolent approach, while the other, perhaps a loose cannon with nothing left to live for, takes a more malevolent tack.
Roe versus Wade, 1973.
Abortion lovers rejoice. The court rules that the right to privacy protects a woman's decision to have an abortion, and the fetus is not a person with constitutional rights, thus ending all debate on this once controversial issue.
Godzilla versus Megalon, 1973.
In a rare foray into international law, the court agreed to settle a dispute between two giant monsters rampaging through the Japanese countryside. In a 7-2 decision, the court found Megalon's emission of lightning from his horn-like appendage did not constitute a violation of Godzilla's civil rights. Frustrated by the decision, Godzilla and attorney Melvin Belli destroyed Tokyo.
Roe versus Brown, 1978.
Due to public demand, the winners of Roe versus Wade and Brown versus Board of Education go head-to-head in an elimination match televised on ABC's Wide World of Sports. The right to have an abortion was upheld 8-1 over the right to desegregated public institutions. Chief Justice Warren Burger later called his participation in this event the most regrettable incident in my entire career.
Bush versus Gore, 2000.
The court votes 5-4 to stop the recount in the disputed Florida election, effectively handing George W. Bush the presidency. In a remarkable coincidence, each justice's decision aligns exactly with his or her party affiliation. An accidental synchronicity, a lonely, unemployed Al Gore muses on each and every evening as he cries himself to sleep.
So You Want to Be a President, by Stephen Colbert. Let's face it, nobody wants to die, least of all me. Thankfully, I have achieved the immortality of celebrity, whereas if you paid for this audiobook, you're probably not famous, or else we would have given you a copy just to make sure it showed up at the right parties, if you know what I mean, which, again, you probably don't. My point is, the wolf of oblivion will soon be lapping his eternal tongue at your door, and none of your pleading will save you from the hungering darkness. On the bright side, there is a way for your name to live forever in the annals of legal history. It's called being a precedent, and if a no-name like Roe, not her real name, or that asshole Wade can do it, so can you. It's easy. First, have something awful happen to you, like getting arrested without being read your rights, not being allowed to go to school due to your race, or picking up a cup of coffee that's a tad too hot. But, and this is important, you can't have one of those. They've already been precedented. Is precedented even a word, you may ask? Well, it is now, Noah fucking Webster. I just precedented it. So, not only must it be something awful, but it has to be uniquely awful and constitutionally interesting. Then you're in business, recording. Gay marriage is very hot. Unfortunately for you, a slew of gays, and slew is the correct term for more than one homosexual, have a head start on that one, so just marrying a gay man probably won't cut it. You might have to marry two gay men, or if polyhomoligamy's been done, make one of the gay men a transgendered monkey who's in a coma, and you want the right to pull the plug as one of its husbands, and heal it with the power of prayer in our public schools. Nobody said this was going to be easy. Think of yourself as a pioneer of suffering, and brace yourself for the excruciatingly slow turning of the wheels of justice. Remember, there were countless fugitive slaves, but only one, Dred Scott, had the patience to endure the vicissitudes of America's legal system. But it was all worth it when he made it to the highest court in the land and was told by the Chief Justice that he was A, wrong, and B, not a man, but a piece of property.
His true reward, however, would come years later, after he was dead, and it was of no use to him. For his case was a precedent, and today it is discussed by historians, memorized by high school students, and joked about by assholes like myself. Care to join him? Stephen Colbert is the chief defender of international war crimes at the World Court in The Hague. He is personally unpleasant. If I Were a Supreme Court Justice, by Ed Helms.
When I heard earlier in this chapter how the job of Supreme Court Justice is a lifetime gig, I immediately realized it's the perfect job for me. Plus, I'm pretty interested in the law. A Supreme Court Justice is the custodian of our legal integrity and must lead by example. That is why I would start all my remarks with, for example. For example, if I were a Supreme Court Justice, I would make it illegal to break the law. Just seems like a no-brainer, people. I would approach every argument with an open mind. Too often, Supreme Court justices let their ideologies determine the outcome before they've heard the arguments. Also, I would let my faith completely inform my decision-making. I mean, let's be honest, there really is only one judge. His name is Jesus Christ. And he cries when babies die. Justice Ed Helms, however, would make it a point to be the most unpredictable judge on the bench. Swingin' Ed Helms, they'd call me, because I could go either way on any case. And also because I'd use my position to get ungodly amounts of high-class trim. Another thing I would do as an active judge is revisit poor decisions the court has made in the past. In United States versus La Vengeance, 1796, the court granted the federal government maritime authority over inland waterways. That's bullshit! I firmly believe the government should not have this authority at any time, let alone maritime. Also, I would order the immediate death of Roger Simpson, the one who lives at 1310 North 7th Avenue, Apartment 12A, Oroville, California. He knows why. For a closing argument, let me just say this. Vote Ed Helms for Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Ed Helms is a 5th District Circuit Court judge representing the Northern Great Plains. Discussion questions. 1. How many of the 9 Supreme Court justices can you name? How many of the 9 members of the Brady Bunch can you name? What does that say about you? 2. Ginsburg or O'Connor? Or, if you are female, Scalia or Stevens? 3. At what point during a typical Supreme Court hearing is it most appropriate to leap to your feet and shout, "I'm out of order? This whole court's out of order!" 4. Name 5 differences between a gavel and an ordinary hammer. 5. If the current justices of the Supreme Court were a baseball team, which position would each one play? What position would each play if they were a cricket team, not counting the wicketkeeper and bowler? Which justice, past or present, do you think would make the best deep mid-wicket? 6. Separation of church and state is one of the fundamental principles of our government, yet court witnesses are required to swear on the Bible. Justify this. Classroom activities. 1. Using felt and yarn, make a hand puppet of Clarence Thomas. Ta-da! You're Antonin Scalia. 2. Have the entire class dress up in black robes and put white wigs on. Observe how much easier it is to get serious work done. 3. Make a god's eye from popsicle sticks and yarn. Then teach your students about the one true judge, the Lord. 4. Explain to the class that most Supreme Court justices decide cases along predictable ideological lines, but there are swing justices who could go either way, and therefore are fun to bet on. Start a bookmaking operation, collecting wagers from your students on which way the justices will vote. While you're at it, start a death pool. Many justices are on their last legs. 5. Make the judicial branch come alive for your students by conducting mock Supreme Court proceedings in the case Smelt It v. Dealt It. 6. Have your students re-argue Colgrove v. Green, 328 U.S. 549, 1946, to determine if, as Colgrove argued, the Illinois congressional districts lacked compactness of territory and approximate equality of population. That'll teach the little shits for chewing gum in class. Chapter 6, Campaigns and Elections,
America changes the sheets. In this chapter, you will marvel at colonial-era button-making technology. Learn why your vote counts, but not nearly as much as your money. Continue to be bored by the issue of campaign finance reform. Learn the hottest new debate techniques from Dirty Dancing choreographer Kenny Ortega.
Now that you have heard the first five chapters and assimilated every word into the fiber of your being, or have randomly started the disc here while taking a dump, you are ready to learn about campaigns and elections. In brief, campaigns and elections are democracy's vetting process. Democracy sounds good on paper, but how do we know it won't explode when we start it? Campaigns and elections are where the idealism and elegant design of the American experiment are set free to see if they can survive in the wild. Initially, the process of conducting campaigns and holding elections was conceived as a means to an end, the peaceful transfer of power. But more than two centuries of refinements have elevated the process to an end in itself. Indeed, it can be said campaigns and elections have become the most important part of the democratic cycle, easily crushing the overrated governance of the people. Today, running for office takes as much, if not more, time, energy, and resources as holding it. Think that's an inefficient perversion of our political system? Run for office and change it. Although the skills needed to woo voters are at times diametrically opposed to those necessary to govern them, the expensive and arduous process exists for a reason: to ensure that those who wish to govern are, if not the most qualified our country has to offer, at least the ones who want it the most. The ones who want it so badly they will endure any humiliation just to catch but a whiff of the aphrodisiac that is power. As Nixon famously said of Hubert Humphrey, his opponent in the 1968 presidential election,
"Yes, my opponent is wise. Yes, he is honorable. But is he willing to kill anybody who stands in his way?"
Nixon's subsequent triumph was proof of the system's central tenet. Campaigns and elections are the process in which democracy separates the willing from the able and goes with the willing. Running for office, the toughest job you'll never love. Do you like babies? How about veterans? Can you feign interest in old people and smile while touching them? How are you with handshaking, backslapping, palm greasing? How do you feel about saying the same thing over and over again? Bus travel. Do you like being vilified on television? What about in print? Your spouse and children. Do they enjoy being followed around, maybe having their backgrounds looked into? Chicken? Can you stomach copious quantities of it in a sterile auditorium-like environment? And finally, do you like all those things enough to put up with them every day for the remainder of your professional life? If you answered yes to every one of those questions, congratulations! You're ready to enter the political arena. And not a moment too soon. As our country has grown in size and stature, the scope of political campaigns has kept pace. The election cycle itself is fixed, but everything else around it has expanded, sometimes grotesquely. The most significant change to campaigns over the years has been cost. And while if you are considering a run for office, you no doubt have an impressive personal fortune, only the rarest breed of politician can foot the bill on his own. So that means fundraising, and lots of it. Savvy candidates know that without a powerful fundraising organization, they will lose. But I have a prescription for what ails our country and can lead. Stop. You will lose. And raising money takes time, so plan on at least a year of nonstop solicitation to adequately compete. Don't worry, there will be plenty of time to come up with core beliefs and policies after you've been elected. Still doubt the importance of money in political races? Billionaire Ross Perot received 19% of the presidential vote in 1992, despite being clinically insane. Fortunately, candidates don't go it alone. Whether seeking city, state, or federal office, they are undoubtedly running under the auspices of one of America's two political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. Yes, there's probably some state senator in Oregon who belongs to the Green Party, but let's face it, Hippie Q McFreakington ain't going anywhere outside the greater Eugene area. The Republican Party is the party of nostalgia. It seeks to return America to a simpler, more innocent and moral past that never actually existed. The Democrats are utopians. They seek to create an America so fair and non-judgmental that life becomes an unbearable series of apologies. Together, the two parties function like giant down comforters, allowing a candidate to disappear into the enveloping softness, protecting them from exposure to the harsh weather of independent thought. The parties provide candidates with the structure, financial support, and enthusiastic placard waivers critical for running a political campaign. In exchange, the candidate agrees to never take sides against the party. This agreement is typically signed in the blood of a candidate's firstborn, though the party may make exceptions for those who promise to kill a hobo in front of them. Each party has a platform, a prefix menu of beliefs making up its worldview. The candidate can choose one of the two platforms, but remember, no substitutions. For example, do you support universal health care? Then you must also want a ban on assault weapons. Pro-limited government? Congratulations, you are also anti-abortion. Luckily, all human opinion falls neatly into one of the two clearly defined camps. Thus, the two-party system elegantly reflects the bichromatic rainbow that is American political thought. From time to time in our history, there have been movements to create third parties. When introduced into a marriage, a third party can add a dash of spice and unpredictability to a relationship long loveless and dead. But as they say in electoral politics, two's company, three's a problem that must be undermined through legislative obstacles to their financing. Yet, still they live. In 2000, the Green Party's Ralph Nader received thousands of votes that may have otherwise gone to Democrat Al Gore. Many say Nader's run cost Gore the presidency. Some egged his house. Still others crank-called him at all hours of the day, saying, "Thanks a lot, asshole." One man lit a paper bag filled with dog shit and placed it on Nader's front step. Ralph Nader wishes people would stop doing this. But to be fair, he is the one who tried to change the system. The campaign trail, learning to hate the land you'll govern. Your party affiliation set and fundraising apparatus in motion, it is now time to dive headlong into the political fray by forming an exploratory committee. Exploratory committees are groups of one or more of your best friends whose job it is to tell you how much people like you. As it turns out, people like you a lot. The matter thus explored, you can file the necessary papers and declare your candidacy. It is now time to develop the strategy that will win you the power you have craved since that beating in eighth grade. Step one is to define yourself. Distilling the ideas and intangibles of your candidacy into an easily digestible archetype can be meticulous and frustrating work. Thank God there are only two choices. The outsider. Outsiderdom is the strategy best suited to first-time candidates or veteran candidates who always lose. It reflects the distaste the public has for politics as usual, and inside the Beltway experts agree the outsider persona is the best choice for today's wannabe insider. You don't want to use the word outsider too much in your campaign, however, so feel free to have your team of seasoned campaign managers, political operatives, and speechwriters use synonyms like grassroots, maverick, and populist. Just make sure no one looks at your business cards and decides to use billionaire financier. The important thing is you know nothing about Washington and don't have a clue how the system operates. The insider. In the very likely event you are an incumbent, the whole outsider thing isn't going to work. Time for Plan B, running as the guy with experience. This means you are a seasoned Washington veteran who has gotten things done and risen above politics to make the type of tough, unpopular decisions that have gotten you reelected to 19 consecutive terms in the House. You know everything about Washington and know exactly how the system operates. That doesn't mean you're out of touch. After all, Hootie and the Blowfish did play at your last rally, and by all accounts, rocked. And if all else fails, remind constituents the defense plant 80% of them work at wouldn't be there if you hadn't snuck the appropriation into a cancer research bill. A third option is running as your own man. Good luck with that. Now that you've defined yourself, it is time for the more important task of defining your opponent. Remember, labels stick, so make up a good one. It needs to be simple, easily repeatable, and able to latch onto the electorate's collective unconscious like a deer tick on a fawn. Here's a list of some pre-vetted favorites.
Draft Dodger. Flip-flopper. Liberal. East Coast Liberal. West Coast Liberal. Tax and Spender. Womanizer. Soft on defense. Soft on crime. Soft on fabric.
Note, all these phrases are typically used by Republicans to define Democrats. This is because Republicans are superior to Democrats with this political technique. In fact, Republicans are superior to Democrats with all political techniques. Try not to refer to your opponent with these more explicit labels that may reflect badly upon your character.
Major League Asshole. War Hero. Fagatini. Tard. His Satanic Majesty.
Remember, when in doubt, your mic is open. Now that candidacy has been established and opponents defined, campaign season begins in earnest. In most cases, this is a 3 to 6 month dash to election day. Depending on the office, candidates may first have to fight through a primary, which is like a general election, except it's against people of their own party and no one votes. Primary or no, election season is a time when those who already hold office put aside their responsibilities to get out there and meet the people whose needs they are now officially neglecting. Imagine being a secretary at an office and every 2 or 4 years taking 6 months off to reapply for the same job. Wouldn't that make your office more efficient? Oh, also, you are getting paid during the time you take off. Every campaign features a few common elements. All of them are necessary. One is important. Meeting constituents. This is accomplished by interrupting potential voters at a diner. Ask them questions. Stump speeches. Touch them. Look at them. Not with disdain. Oftentimes, these appearances are accompanied by a short distillation of exactly who the candidate is, written by someone else. These are called stump speeches because they are to oratory what a stump is to a tree. Endorsements. If a fellow politician, celebrity, or respected media publication puts its support behind a candidate, voters will follow. This is the theory behind endorsements. It has yet to work. In fact, in some cases, endorsements may even hurt a candidacy. For example, Barbara Streisand. Anything she touches turns to shit. Debates. One of the nobler political traditions, the debate dates back to ancient Greece and Rome, where the ability to defend one's position was seen as manifest proof of the rightness of that position. Then Nixon flop-sweated in 60. Since then, the debate has focused less on a mastery of the issues and more on base, rouge, and eyeliner. A pancake effect can make a candidate look waxy, but an insufficient base may expose unsightly blemishes and pocked skin. Character flaws no amount of rhetorical prowess can overcome. Advertising. Now we're talking. Hectic campaign pace got you down? Your opponent seems to be right on too many issues? Buy some advertising time. It is the elixir to cure any ailing campaign, whether a candidate is introducing himself, reintroducing himself, explaining himself, defending himself, reinventing himself, or simply destroying his opponent. TV is the medium of choice. And here's the best part. There are no rules. Political advertising cannot be held to the same high truth standards of, say, a beer commercial. Try it. Refer to your opponent as Hitler-esque. You've got nothing to lose but any chance of ever going to heaven. Elections. Oh, those were today? It's finally Election Day, the day Americans celebrate their democracy. And while Election Day isn't a federal holiday, it is held on a Tuesday, for convenience. On Election Day, Americans exercise their fundamental right to vote. Or not. 55% to 70% vote for the latter. It is perhaps a sign of the strength of our republic that so few people feel the need to participate. That must be the reason. Typically, voting is done in church basements or middle school gymnasiums, staffed by well-intentioned volunteers whose naive enthusiasm more than makes up for their blind incompetence. At their disposal, technology at least 50 to 75 years behind its time, because if it was good enough for McKinley, it's good enough for us. With no national standard for conducting elections, states and municipalities are free to oversee them as they see fit. Ballots differ from state to state, though common elements generally include a booth, a curtain, and a disproportionate number of old people. Given the intricacies of conducting an election, it is surprising so few have been disputed. This is largely because in most elections, margins of error are dwarfed by the differences in vote tallies. This was not the case, however, in 2000, when a hotly contested presidential race hinged on outdated equipment, poorly designed ballots, and ill-prepared county supervisors. It laid bare a system in dire need of an immediate emergency overhaul. So look for that. Then, just like that, the results you already know from weeks of internal and exit polling are in. Results usually go one of two ways. You've lost. Thank your staffers. They could have worked harder, but now is not the time to tell them that. The next step is making the difficult phone call, through gritted teeth and crushed ego, to your opponent. Though over the past few days he has said things about you that in certain Middle Eastern countries would get his tongue cut out, you must offer your congratulations and pledge your support. You will spend the better part of the next 3 years working tirelessly towards his destruction. But keep that to yourself. Now go out there, failure that you are, and deliver a concession speech allowing you to exit the political arena with whatever is left of your dignity. The cameras are on. You are surrounded by loved ones and supporters. There is red, white, and blue bunting that in your current mood can't help but strike you as temptingly flammable. It's been a good run. Good luck with your memoirs, consulting job, extended ski vacation, or slow, depressing slide into obscurity. With any luck, you'll at least be an historical footnote. Or you've won! Pop the champagne! You just got off the phone with your douchebag opponent, whose choked back venom you couldn't help but chuckle at. Fuck him! Your junior communications director is massaging your balls while the deputy pollster works the shaft. It's good to be the king. Now go out there before the cheering throngs and tell them this is a time for unity. Make sure you throw in a couple of black people and someone in a wheelchair behind you to prove you meant all that crap about inclusion. Enjoy the evening. Tomorrow, you wake up an office holder elect, and the real work begins. Running for re-election.
Supplemental material. Your campaign team. The seven people you need to put you in the White House. The chief strategist.
Krusty. Often best friend of candidate, either from college or youthful insider trading real estate scandal. Soul rotting from inside out. Would make a very good president one day if not for his crippling lack of likability.
The young idealist.
He's jacked in. Doesn't talk about Southern voters, instead uses dynamic phrases like New South. Eventually will become odious talking head for whichever news network offers nicest gift basket. Watch what you say around him. The notes he is taking will find their way into book form.
The pollster, a.k.a. the sweaty buzzkill.
No one will meet him. He does not exist, because you, as a candidate, pay no attention to polls. Do not do anything until you talk to him first. The only person left on Earth who seeks out bicarbonate of soda to cure gastrointestinal ills. By the way, make sure you have bicarbonate of soda.
The policy analyst.
Finally, a place for a woman of color, in charge of your healthcare initiative. Bugs you about going into more detail about your healthcare initiative. Doesn't understand no one gives a shit about her healthcare initiative. After your election, she will quit out of frustration for your lack of commitment to the healthcare initiative.
The opposition researcher.
Starts every sentence with, back when I was in black ops. Cites Nietzsche way too much. Does research on your opponent, which he then blends with fiction and innuendo to create fact. Keeps dossier on own mother. Will offer to take care of young idealist after book comes out. Take him up on it.
The communications director.
Finally, a place for a woman. Has unique ability to convert or spin any piece of remotely negative information into a positive. In short, she is a liar. But she is your liar. Try not to have sex with her.
The advertising director.
Madison Avenue refugee. Quit ad game to do something real. responsible for showing human side of candidate by filming him inside a classroom filled with young minorities, or on a street shaking hands with grown-up minorities, is himself fearful of minorities, relies heavily on Minority Wrangler.
The five greatest moments in negative advertising.
Negative advertising turns the spotlight on the other candidate in an attempt to lower his standing in the eyes of voters. Once seen as a last-ditch effort to salvage a flagging campaign, going negative has proven so effective, today's political candidates rely almost exclusively on it. Some say this cheapens the political discourse and turns people off to the entire process. But really, once you've portrayed a one-armed, no-legged war hero as a traitor to his country, what process is there to go back to?
1. Barry Goldwater will kill us all. 1964.
President Lyndon B. Johnson's 1964 Daisy ad ran only one time, but made an indelible impression. Its image of a young girl counting flower petals before being vaporized by a mushroom cloud implied Johnson's Republican rival, Barry Goldwater, would lead the nation to nuclear war. In Johnson's defense, Goldwater's campaign itself also implied he would lead the nation to nuclear war. The conservative senator from Arizona was defeated handily by Johnson. The next year, Goldwater started a nuclear war.
2. Michael Dukakis, Friend of the Rapist, 1988.
Seeking to portray Democratic opponent Michael Dukakis as soft on crime, the campaign of George H.W. Bush produced the Willie Horton ad, suggesting that as governor of Massachusetts, Dukakis had personally requested a weekend furlough for convict Willie Horton, then drove him to Maryland, where he assaulted and kidnapped a young couple. As a result of the ad, Dukakis promptly replaced Horton as his running mate.
Three, Grover Cleveland's Bastard Child, 1884.
When supporters of James G. Blaine discovered his opponent Grover Cleveland had fathered a son out of wedlock, they distributed handbills featuring a cartoon ridiculing the bastard child. Blaine lost anyway, giving presidents carte blanche for all eternity to have indiscriminate sex without political consequence, fellatio not included.
4. Goody Proctor is a witch, 1692.
The Salem witch trials of 1692 marked the birth of negative advertising in America. Pamphlets outlining allegations of witchcraft, citing specific details of its practice, gave accusations a gravitas that standing in the town square pointing at passers-by and screaming hysterically, "Witch!" simply couldn't provide. But negative advertising proved short-lived in Salem society. Puritans soon grew ashamed of the evil practice, and as a sincere act of repentance, stoned the pamphleteer to death. Then, just to be safe, they drowned his family.
5. Caligula, not so bad. 39 A.D.
Widely recognized as a tyrannical megalomaniac who prided himself on cruelty and ruled through fear, Caligula was nearly undone by an underground smear campaign to depict him as a pretty nice guy. Other sculptures and frescoes of the time libelously show him flying a kite and helping an old lady across the Appian Way. An incensed Caligula immediately went into damage control mode by publicly sodomizing a puppy.
Of Course Your Vote Counts, by Stephen Colbert. In every election, many people grapple with a nagging suspicion that their vote doesn't count. As a citizen and someone who is always right, it is respectively my duty and my pleasure to tell them they are wrong. In fact, our democracy depends on every citizen recognizing the value of their vote. And here's the value of that vote. In the most recent presidential election, 105,360,260 people cast ballots. That means each person's vote counted 0.00000949%. I defy you to find a mathematician who will tell you that number is less than or equal to zero. Okay, so we can agree your vote counts. It counts 0.00000949%. Swish that around in your mouth for a while.
How does it taste? Tastes like freedom? 'Cause to me it tastes like jackal squat. This brings up a related, better question than does your vote count? Namely, does your vote make a difference? To answer that, perhaps a more visual comparison would be illustrative. Imagine your vote as a deer tick, and the election as the continent of Asia. Do you notice the relative size of these two things? See how the deer tick appears in comparison with the largest continent on Earth? This gives you a rough idea of the difference your vote makes vis-a-vis the entire electorate. But there is good news. Due to the rampant and growing cynicism of people who feel their vote doesn't make a difference, voter turnout is steadily decreasing. Where the cynicism comes from escapes me, but it means that with each electoral cycle, the value of one vote increases. Now, it's difficult to imagine a day when the candidates running don't vote, so that's two votes right there. But it's not difficult to imagine a day when only one other person bothers to vote. And oh, what a valuable vote that would be. You're welcome. Stephen Colbert has received the Werner Heisenberg Prize for Excellence in Theoretical Mathematics 7 consecutive years, yet can barely feed himself. Do you have it?
To truly succeed in public office, a politician needs an indefinable quality above and beyond intelligence, dedication, and any grasp of the issues. The French call it je ne sais quoi. Americans, who aren't pretentious snobs and don't need fancy words to make them feel all cool, call it.
Do you have it?
1. Do people from different ethnic and socioeconomic backgrounds feel comfortable with you, even when you neither know nor care about them? 2. Can you express strong emotion on cue? 3. Do you have disciples? 4. Do strangers offer you sex with little or no coaxing? 5. Does your portrait look good framed and hung over a bureaucrat's desk? 6. In school, did you have few true friends but dozens of student council campaign volunteers? 7. Have your children written memoirs casting you as an emotionally unavailable enigma? 8. Do people feel like they are the only ones in the room when you are speaking to them? 9. Do rooms feel like they're the only ones in the house when you are in them? 10. Are you able to pass off glaring defects of character as lovable quirks? 11. When you play tag, are you often it? 12. Is your hair flecked with enough gray to make it seem like you've been around the block, but not so much to make you Medicare-y?
If you answered yes 1 to 4 times, you have insufficient it, but leave your name and maybe you can stuff some envelopes or something. If you answered yes 5 to 8 times, you possess enough it to be a moderately successful city-level administrator and or local news anchorman. If you answered yes more than 9 times, you are it rich. Assemble an exploratory committee and weigh your options. Discussion questions. 1. What the hell does it mean to rock a vote? Can a vote be R&B'd? Singer-songwritered? 2. Seriously, how come at 18 we're like old enough to vote, but we can't have beer? 3. Which of the following is the best combination of reasons to vote for a candidate? A. Issues and eyes. B. Party affiliation and hair. C. Background and teeth. D. Religious zealotry and tits. 4. Can we put a sign in your yard? 5. Has your mother been seeing that guy Phil? Has he stayed over? Stop crying. It's very important that you tell me. 6. Minorities like African Americans, Asians, and Hispanics make up an increasingly large percentage of the American population, yet are underrepresented in public office. In fact, there is not a single black elected Republican in Congress. Do minorities think they are too good for Republicans or something? Classroom activities. 1. Make the Electoral College come alive. Divide your entire school into 50 groups of varying sizes. Then assign a point value to each group roughly based on its size. Have each individual student then vote on an issue, say, chocolate or vanilla. Tally the votes, but tell them the side with the most votes isn't necessarily the winner. Instead, calculate the winner within each of the 50 groups, then give the previously assigned point value to the respective flavor. Add up the point values and see who has more. Isn't this a better way to figure out a winner? 2. Disenfranchise a black student. 3. Have the students choose an official song for their imaginary run for president. Make sure it isn't that rap metal crap they listen to. Chapter 7. The Media, Democracy's Guardian Angel. In this chapter, you will learn how to identify political bias in today's liberal, bleeding-heart, Jew, and gay-run media. Become an unnamed source. Create your own no-spin zone. Discover which media conglomerate now owns you. Not have your opinion of Geraldo Rivera particularly improved upon.
A free and independent press is essential to the health of a functioning democracy. It serves to inform the voting public on matters relevant to its well-being. Why they've stopped doing that is a mystery. I mean, 300 camera crews outside a courthouse to see what Kobe Bryant is wearing when the judge sets his hearing date while false information used to send our country to war goes unchecked. What the fuck happened? These spineless cowards in the press have finally gone too far. They have violated a trust. Was the president successful in convincing the country? Who gives a shit? Why not tell us if what he said was true? And the excuses, my God, the excuses. Hey, we just give the people what they want. What can we do? This administration is secretive. Oh, but the last season of Friends really is news. The unmitigated gall of these weak-willed. You're supposed to be helping us, you indecent piles of shit. Fuck it. Just fuck it.
This is the editor again. We sincerely apologize for this false start. The authors have assured us it was a momentary lapse in restraint caused by a deadline-induced Red Bull binge. In no way was it meant to portray any sense of anger and or disappointment in the behavior and standards of the modern media. Chapter 7. The Media, Democracy's Guardian Angel.
What is the role of a free and independent press in a democratic society? Is it to be a passive conduit responsible only for the delivery of information between a government and its people? Is it to aggressively print allegation and rumor independent of accuracy or fairness? Is it to show boobies? No. The role of a free press is to be the people's eyes and ears, providing not just information but access, insight, and most importantly, context. It must devote its time and resources to monitoring the government, permeating the halls of power to determine who is doing the people's work, who is corrupting the process, and who will promise to be a mole in the State Department if their homosexuality is kept secret. Only after that, and only with time permitting, should it move on to high-speed freeway chases. For government to truly be for the people, its inner workings must be exposed for the public to see. This lofty goal is known as transparency. And while this could be accomplished by sheathing all elected officials in public buildings in saran wrap, this has been deemed unwieldy, expensive, and creepy. Instead, transparency is achieved via a free press, something so vital to democracy it has historically been given equal stature to the three branches of government, hence its nickname, the Fourth Estate. No less an authority than Thomas Jefferson wrote,
"If it were left to me to decide whether we should have a government without a free press or a free press without a government, I would prefer the latter. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a lunchtime appointment with a fine slice of brown sugar." That last part's off the record.
So has the American press lived up to the lofty status envisioned by the Founding Fathers? No. It has surpassed them. And the story of how the media transformed itself from a mere public necessity into an entertaining profit center for ever-expanding corporate empires is an inspirational one. One that will hopefully be optioned by our parent company's film arm and turned into a movie of the same name. The media in American history. Perhaps at no other time in our history has the media played a more vital role than in the American Revolution. Yet back then, only two forms of media existed, the town crier and the pamphlet. The town crier focused mainly on local news and had a circulation of whoever was walking by. In contrast, the pamphlet was more meditative, analyzing and offering perspective on the day's events. It also included the occasional personal. Imagine the tiny booklet for sale by the Barnes & Noble cash register. Now imagine that instead of offering you 365 reasons why golf is better than tantric sex, it urged you to cast off your oppressor and don the mantle of dignity that is every man's birthright. That's a pamphlet. Thomas Paine was the most famous pamphleteer of his day, and his manifesto Common Sense is widely credited with inspiring the young colonies to revolution. Not bad for a tract composed primarily of observations such as,
"Though it look a bit like a comb, a fork is not a comb, and woe be to any maid who confuse 'em."
And the hilarious litany of insults entitled, "You might be a red coat if." Pamphleteers looked down on town criers, considering them glorified parchment readers, blurring the line between information and yelling. Pamphlets took time to print, however, and criers would have their revenge, with the major breaking news story, "The British were coming." Paul Revere's midnight broadcast would be remembered as an essential piece of American lore. Less remembered were the following week's pamphlet headlines, "The British came." The Founding Fathers were so grateful to the media for their role in the Revolution that the foremost inalienable right codified in the Constitution's Bill of Rights was the First Amendment, which guaranteed freedom of speech and freedom of the press. This right was revoked in 1798 by the Alien and Sedition Acts, but still, it had been a fun 9 years. And when the Sedition Acts expired in 1801, the government pledged to never again use legislation to censor the media, vowing to only use intimidation and coercion from that day forward. The newspaper, pulp faction. The 19th century saw the invention of ink that rubbed off on your hands, paving the way for the rise of the newspaper, a little bundle of democracy and coupons delivered right to your door. Dedicated to congressional debates and political arguments ranging from slavery to universal suffrage, newspapers sucked. The public wanted stories of tragedy, crime, and entertainment, preferably all three at once. So savvy publishers began gathering titillating gossip, experimenting with gigantic typefaces, and invented a unique way to cross words in puzzle form. In doing so, they created a new kind of newspaper called a tabloid. By the end of the century, tabloids would have their greatest triumph, plunging our nation into an unnecessary war. 1898. As tension grew between America and Spain over the Spanish colony of Cuba, newspaper magnates William Randolph Hearst and William Pulitzer engaged in a far more significant battle over circulation numbers. Each paper fought to outdo the other with salacious or made-up stories of Spanish atrocities, fanning the flames of a newfound American nationalism. Just as the war between Hearst and Pulitzer was about to get violent, relief came in the form of a ship, the USS Maine, accidentally blowing up in Havana Harbor, killing more than 200 Americans. The papers blamed the Spanish, and presto, the resulting war raised circulation for both men, and the pair's blend of fiction, bigotry, and jingoism became known as yellow journalism. Later, the phrase was shortened to journalism. Radio. With great frequency comes great responsibility. Mass production of cheap newspapers helped unite and inform the populace of a growing nation. But at what price? Keeping abreast of the public discourse through newspapers took a great physical toll on the citizenry. The journey to purchase the paper, the turning of its many pages, to say nothing of the looking, the incessant looking. Left to right, up and down, the nation's eyes were strained at the very time she needed them to see if the coolies had finished building the railroads. And what of the illiterate? Shouldn't the people least capable of making informed decisions have equal say? Something had to give, and that something was radio. Through the magic of radio, people could stay informed without having to read. They could listen while remaining sedentary, with their eyes closed, perhaps gnawing on a delicious shank of lamb. Few could have imagined radio's influence based on the inanity of the first voice radio transmission.
1, 2, 3, 4. Is it snowing where you are?
But the message broadcast in response,
typical. Weak-kneed liberal whining about the weather while decent Americans are out there shoveling.
Pointed the way to what was to come. Radio transformed democracy. Not only was news and information now available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but the birth of nationwide networks meant people in San Francisco were listening to the exact same broadcast as people in Baltimore, though of course they gated up for San Francisco. The new medium offered not only such wildly popular radio shows as The Shadow, Fibber McGee, and Uncle Petey's Old Time Sound Effects Hour, but also high-quality broadcast journalism from such noted correspondents as Edward R. Murrow and Crazy Hindenburg Guy. But perhaps the biggest change ushered in by radio was the expanded role of corporate sponsorship. Large companies not only paid for advertising time, but often sponsored entire shows, demanding input over content along the way. More than one analyst of the day lamented how the influence of Chesterfield cigarettes besmirched the creative integrity of the hilarious minstrel show Amos and Andy. Indeed, an important precedent was being set. Corporations would henceforward have a hand in disseminating information to the public. Would those hands be used to gently push information along, massage it a little, or throttle it to within an inch of its life? That would be left to a new medium to decide. TV. Shiny, pretty TV. Mass production of cheap radios helped unite and inform the populace of a growing nation. But at what price? The radio's over-reliance on words had forced Americans to connect mental image to narrative. The country's imagination was dangerously well-developed at the very moment we needed not to think about what dropping an atomic bomb on someone might look like. Couldn't anyone create a device that would numb not just one, but all our senses, so information concerning our government could be absorbed by osmosis in the course of gathering the family to watch a funny man in a dress? Finally came the breakthrough mankind had been waiting for, television. Hypnotic, absorbing, shut the hell up, kids, can't you see I'm watching Sullivan? Television. Exactly where television originated is a mystery, though most scholars believe Prometheus stole it from the gods and gave it to the RCA Victor Company. In any case, TV quickly asserted itself as the dominant medium of the 20th century, overtaking newspapers, radio, and the film industry, while simultaneously barring ugly people from ever participating in civic life again. Never was this last fact more apparent than in 1960, when America watched Richard Nixon, ugly, and John Kennedy, square off in the nation's first televised presidential debate. Nixon refused any but the crudest makeup and unwisely chose to wear his own nose. By contrast, Kennedy arrived at the studio deeply tanned from a swing through California and flush with youthful confidence, having just been rimmed out by Jane Mansfield. A majority of TV viewers said Kennedy had won the debate, while a majority of radio listeners said Nixon had come out on top. The conclusion was obvious. Radio was dead. But television did have its downside, visceral immediacy. The country rushed headlong into the television age just in time to catch President Kennedy's assassination and 58,000 Americans die in Vietnam. The nightly barrage of gruesome combat images, followed by the equally gruesome laughing, helped turn the tide of public opinion against the war and brought a premature end to the careers of Lyndon B. Johnson and Ruth Buzzy. In just two decades, TV established itself as the dominant form of media in America. By the early 1970s, the three major networks had been established and a new breed of celebrity. The Anchorman had donned his moosed mantle atop the news kingdom. Though the 60s had seen its share of tumult, most Americans still maintained a fundamental faith in our government institutions. Shit, we put a man on the moon in 69. That's what you call ending a decade on a high note. Then the newspaper, long left for dead, reached its icy hand up from the grave, grabbed hold of a president, and brought him a tumbling down. Watergate. Shame of a press corps. June 17, 1972. Five gentlemen are arrested breaking into the Democratic National Committee offices at the Watergate Hotel. The men are not loud or abusive, and are there only at the behest of the Nixon administration to adjust bugging devices installed in a previous break-in. It was a simple case of the executive branch having a little good-natured fun with a respected political opponent. That is, until two reporters for the Washington Post, drunk on curiosity, decided to blow the whole thing into proportion. For months, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein terrorized Washington by calling people and asking questions, oftentimes not during normal business hours. Ultimately, their bullying tactics intimidated the Senate into stopping everything it was doing to look into it. That's when TV, recognizing Vietnam was winding down and needing a new hit, decided to get in the game. Its broadcast of the Senate Watergate Committee hearings gave the public an unprecedented behind-the-scenes look at our government. This made people very, very sad. On August 8, 1974, Richard M. Nixon, a good man brought down by a press corps run amok, resigned. His final speech to the nation, containing the immortal line, "I would prefer you hadn't known I was a crook," was a not-so-subtle jab at the out-of-control media. The entire affair cast a stain on the profession of journalism and has become known as the media's Watergate. Thankfully, Woodward and Bernstein got their comeuppance by having the insufferable Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford satirize them in a movie. The Modern Mediascape, Original Synergy. Today's media has recovered from its mid-70s bout of temporary insanity. Newspapers abound, and though they have endured decades of decline in readership and influence, they can still form impressive piles if no one takes them out to the trash. The radio star, allegedly killed by video in 1981, staged a comeback in the 1980s, as the medium's abandoned husk was recolonized as an outpost for the paranoid and partisan. It now exists as a pacifier, reassuring the aggrieved that the government's recognition of Kwanzaa really is the reason their lives suck. It also helps cab drivers learn English. Very angry English. Television continues to thrive. One 15-minute nightly newscast, barely visible through the smoky haze of its cigarette company benefactor, has evolved into a multi-channel, 24-hour-a-day, infotastic clusterfuck of factish-like material. The 1990s brought the advent of a dynamic new medium for news, the Internet, a magnificent new technology combining the credibility of anonymous hearsay with the excitement of typing. But the most important factor in the rehabilitation of our national media came not from the editorial room, but a more unlikely source, the boardroom. The media and Washington, pas de deux. Enter the media's white knight, corporate ownership. During the 1980s, corporations began to bail out our democracy by purchasing as many guerrilla newspaper, radio, and television stations as they could. These mega corporations became known as parent companies because of their patient, nurturing tendencies and for the way they sat the media down and told it, "Hey, you're over 200 years old now. Isn't it about time you settled down and made some money?" Thousands of uncontrollable, perilously independent media voices were finally organized into a more manageable five. And while it may be illegal for one company to own every newspaper, TV, and radio station in a particular town, Rupert Murdoch isn't dead yet. Now more secure in their relationship, government and the media are entering a golden age of harmony, aiding each other whenever possible. Lawmakers recognize that counterbalancing their excesses is a lot of work. So today's government officials, aware of the intense deadline pressure of the 24-hour news cycle, are kind enough to send their media colleagues hard news, known as press releases, or leaks, to be read verbatim on air. The benefits of this are twofold. The public remains informed of the good things the government is up to, and the media is freed up to use its entire arsenal for the next photogenic child's disappearance. When disputes on policy do arise, the two political parties provide the media with analysts that can argue the issue from the only two valid points of view, right and left. These disputes are settled graciously in media forums such as Crossfire, Hardball, and Fuck You with Pat Buchanan and Bill Press. In return for the help killing time, the media agrees not to analyze the truthfulness of the debate, only which team seems to be winning. Without the input of concerned politicians and the briny think tanks they float in, today's journalists would be hamstrung by research demands and unable to provide the speculation we've come to rely on. Yes, our press has never been freer, its status never quoer. By removing the investigative aspect of investigative journalism, today's modern media finally has the time to pursue the ultimate goal the Founding Fathers envisioned for news-gathering organizations, to raise the stock price of the media empire that owns them.
We have media in Canada, too, you know, by Samantha Bee.
Sorry to bother you again. I just wanted to pop in here for a GIF and let you know we have media in Canada, too. In fact, we have all the media. TV, radio, newspapers, and I think even the internet now. They're just like yours, only ours tend to focus less on blowing things up and more on courtesy. The biggest difference between our media and yours is the dominance of the Canadian Broadcasting Company. The CBC is fully funded by the government to produce public interest programming and provide the kind of high-quality television you'd expect from a cash-strapped federal bureaucracy. My grandmother in Chesley loves it. That's near the Bruce. It's a peninsula in Ontario. Ontario? That's a province. A province? You know what? It's our fault for not calling them states. Did you know Shania Twain is from Canada? She is one Canadian who is definitely in the media game. Sorry. The other strange thing about our media is we have Canadian content laws which mandate a certain percentage of our programming be homegrown. I hope that doesn't sound snobby. We know how hard it is for you to find markets for your culture outside your borders, but you might not always be around to make our TV for us. We just want to ensure we protect our essential Canadianness, which we usually define by listing the ways we aren't like Americans. Canadian content laws also ensure Brian Adams is paid the royalties he needs to keep his summer home on Main Island in British Columbia. Other than that, our media is kind of like yours. Honestly, looking back, I don't think the differences were substantial enough to justify this essay. I'm sorry if my abrupt conclusion has created any programming problems.
A who's who of political interviewers.
There is no shortage of venues where politicians can go to take their message directly to the people. Choosing the right one can be the difference between a comfortable re-election and shameful exile to a think tank or, God forbid, academia. Try this menu of television options for today's skilled politician. Looking for credibility? The pundits say your insistence that Russia is a continent makes you a foreign policy lightweight, but a respectable showing on either of these two shows instantly lowers your retardation quotient.
Ted Koppel, Nightline, ABC.
Inside that gigantic head lurks one of the most agile minds in TV journalism. His high standards and unquestioned professionalism are the reason he is only allowed on television very late at night. Do not dissemble, for he can cloud your mind and haunt your dreams. Also, he is a shapeshifter.
Tim Russert, Meet the Press, NBC.
Holding your own against Russert is a political rite of passage akin to the Maasai teenage warrior circumcision ritual, and only slightly easier on your penis. But tread carefully. It's early Sunday morning, and he fact-checks. Need practice? Not quite ready to get in the ring with Tyson? Why not pad your record with Jerry Cooney? Hone your skills on a palooka and lower your risk of being quailed.
George Stephanopoulos, This Week, ABC.
The 9-inch-tall ex-Politico is the perfect host to get you all your sparring and street work. Go ahead. Try out that new talking point, or stumble through a just-hatched damage control strategy. George will put up just enough resistance to help you build strength, but not enough to embarrass. You'll learn which facial expressions best convey earnestness and which body language tics give away your utter contempt for the truth. Don't be afraid to make mistakes, because This Week doesn't count in the official standings. Seeking redemption? Why did you have to take that money, or drug, or person's life? Political career flatlining due to an inherent character flaw? Don't worry. Washington has two defibrillators charged up. Just add tears and... clear!
Larry King. Larry King Live. CNN.
If the word that most often precedes your office title is either disgraced or indicted, it's time for an audience with the King. Larry knows you're a decent person. He'll give you the chance to make up your side of the story. And it's easy to cry on the show, because Larry King smells like onions.
Barbara Walters, 2020, ABC.
Do you need to save your career but are afraid one of the people you have mercilessly screwed over may get through the phone screener? Then Barbara's the one for you. The only thing softer than the focus are the questions, because her relentless pursuit of the interview has created a bond she could never betray. Friends don't do that to friends. for extra coddle, pretend you are still considering giving the exclusive to Diane Sawyer. Looking for comfort or even scorn? The political arena can confuse the ethics and morality of even the most self-assured. If you've forgotten if you're a good guy or a bad guy, why not go on a show that will tell you?
Bill O'Reilly, The O'Reilly Factor, Fox News.
This is the venue for those who could use an immediate and certain judgment concerning their value as human beings. Are you a man amongst men whose moral clarity and vision stand unsurpassed, or a maggot feeding upon the flesh of the dying? You will be told within the first minute of the program, do not question the judgment, accept it, and make the necessary changes. Feeling exhausted? If the political fight has drained you, but you still need television FaceTime to keep up name recognition numbers, head to a program that is a blessed respite for its guests.
Chris Matthews, Hardball, MSNBC.
Talk, talk, talk. Everywhere you go, they expect you to talk. Well, not on Hardball. Matthews will deliver the sound waves. All you need to do is take a page from the guy sitting in the Maxell ad and hang on. As long as you grunt or nod enough to uphold the minimum body language requirement of the social contract, you just bought yourself a half hour of free television time. Caution to asthmatics and those with heart conditions, carbon dioxide levels around Matthews can become dangerously high. In the event of a diatribe, oxygen masks will drop from the ceiling. Help yourself, then help the children.
Diane Sawyer, Primetime Live, ABC.
There is no valid reason to appear with Diane Sawyer.
Discussion questions. 1. What are the top 100 TV shows you would rather watch instead of the nightly news? 2. The Pulitzer Prize is awarded for journalistic excellence. Why is it named for the late 19th century media baron who loathed journalistic excellence? 3. Given human fallibility, is objective reporting ever possible? Phrase your answer without indicating a bias toward one point of view or the other. Classroom activities. 1. Meet the press. Failing that, face the nation. 2. Write the word Reuters on 25 different slips of paper. Pass one out to each student. The one who pronounces it correctly is too smart for your class. Send him or her to private school. 3. Train your pooch to be a media watchdog. Set him in front of a TV and in a firm, commanding voice say, are Democratic candidates getting more airtime than Republicans? Are they, boy? He should bark if they are. 4. Randomly select a sample for your opinion poll. But remember, pick a black person. Also, you're going to want Hispanics in there. Asians you can take or leave. Chapter 8. The Future of Democracy. 67 years from now. In this chapter, you will experience democracy in pill form. Learn how America's growing ethnic diversity will enhance your takeout options. Angrily say aloud, future of democracy, how about some democracy right friggin' now?
Blow it up! Damn you! God damn you all to hell!
Be so close to finishing the audiobook you can taste it.
The great experiment that is the United States of America has succeeded beyond the Founding Fathers' wildest expectations. Even the young nation's most optimistic thinkers estimated the Union would last no more than 30 to 50 years before being torn asunder by internal divisions, i.e. slavery, or external forces. After all, the British, French, Spanish, and the rest of the European continent couldn't go more than 12 years without a good war. But no, thanks to blessedly isolated geography, a can-do spirit, and an indigenous population with primitive weapons and surprisingly weak immune systems, the United States has experienced consistent growth and expansion over its entire history. But what of the future? Will this growth continue unabated? Or will a new power arise and take America's place as heir to the throne of this island Earth? And if a new power does arise, will it make us drive smaller cars? Because right now a lot of SUV owners are in long-term leases, and it's kind of difficult to get out of those without paying some killer fees. Just putting that out there. Speculating about the future is a tricky business. Scientists, sociologists, and religious leaders all have their theories. They are all wrong. But in the interest of fairness, we will briefly present those theories to you now. Then after you've heard those, we will present to you the absolute truth about what will happen in the future. Be warned, however, if you skip ahead now and hear just that part, it won't come true. And it's really great. So unless you want the whole world, especially your children, to be mad at you, keep listening. Democracy's Future Version 1.0. Robots, robots everywhere. In this version of the future, our worst fears about America's increased reliance on technology at the expense of our fundamental humanity are realized. Our democracy will prove ill-equipped to combat the very tools we've created to sustain it. Power will inevitably be centralized in the hands of the very few, those who control the technology and their disproportionately attractive wives. And don't think we'll be able to send a robot back from the future to fix our problems or unplug from some vast computer grid to which we've been enslaved. Our overlords will have seen those movies too, and the dystopia of their creation will be far more original and horrible than anything concocted by Messrs. Cameron and Wachowski. In the techno future, a typical election day will proceed as follows. After learning about political candidates via neurally inserted infochips, the voter of tomorrow will pull on his armless shearling vest, strap on his jetpack, and zip on down to the crumbling middle school gymnasium where they still gamely set up polling stations. Some traditions die harder than others. After consulting the 300-year-old poll worker, he will get in line with his fellow citizens, cyber citizens, and enhanced children, a sub-race of genetically perfect identical blonde toddlers who are only allowed to vote because they can kill with their minds. Thanks for nothing, child tech. Since voter intention became an issue during the 2000 Florida election, high-tech methods of withdrawing opinion will be used. Sedation will be necessary. Fluids, drawn from the spinal column and from beneath the brain's dura mater, will reveal the true intentions of the voter after automated biodemocratic analysis. If you survive the procedure, you'll then verify your vote by punching out holes in a card with a stylus. So much for the mechanics of voting. What of the health of our democracy itself? We are, after all, social creatures. But once technology supplants God and the institution of family, the idea of community will no longer bind us. We will be isolated in ways we could never have imagined, which isn't as bad as it sounds, since we will also no longer have the ability to imagine. While scattered pockets of religious folk and proud Bostonians will still exist here and there, America will exist only as a name on a much swampier map. The era of the superpower will end. Our national greatness will cease to be. On the bright side, Cialis wants you to know rock-hard five-hour erections are only the beginning. Democracy's Future Version 2.0. Viven de largo los Estados Unidos. In this version of the future, our worst fears about America's rapidly shifting demographic landscape overwhelming our federal infrastructure are realized. First up, the Latinos. Like the Kool-Aid man, no wall can contain them. Their numbers will continue to grow until this nation only speaks English as a cute homage, just like the French-speaking Canadians. We will be that lame. Schools will be bilingual, that is, if our Spanish-speaking conquistadors mercifully allow Spanish as a second language to be taught in our escuelas públicas. Desperate and angry Anglos will fight back the only way they know how. White flight. After that fails, they will fight back the other only way they know how, exploiting the law to their advantage. Redrawing congressional districts will fail as a stopgap measure, forcing the wholesale creation of new states. Among those joining the Union, Orange County, Texas too, and an amalgam known as Manhattanchester. North Dakota will split into North North Dakota and Mid North Dakota, while South Dakota will divide itself into Dakota and the Commonwealth of Greater Mount Rushmore Wall Drug. There will be 17 Carolinas. But it will be to no avail. The bloated federal bureaucracy, unable to provide for the growing underclass in all 81 of our states, will collapse. Social services will exist only in pockets of extreme wealth. Tortillas, however, will reach new heights of deliciousness. Meanwhile, outnumbered, outvoted, and outcast, America's Caucasian population will be reduced to a disempowered army of day laborers, wandering the dusty Southwest looking for menial jobs, In perhaps the greatest irony of all this, they will fail to see the irony of all this. Democracy's Future version 3.0, Christ v. Antichrist, whose side are you on? In this version of the future, our best hopes and dreams about Jesus Christ returning and separating out the worthy from the damned are realized. Though the book of Revelation covers this in more detail, the essentials bear mentioning. After the shout of the archangel is heard, the living and the dead in Christ, i.e. those who have not worshipped the beast and are free of his mark upon their foreheads, shall reign with God in heaven for 1,000 years. Then, once the rapture has occurred and the saved are off the planet, the Democrats will regain both the House and the Senate. Democracy's Future version 4.0, the absolute truth. You skipped ahead, didn't you? Or if you didn't, know that someone else did and ruined the future for you. For all of us, really. You know, like when Lot and his wife were told not to look back on Sodom and Gomorrah. You know what happened. She was turned into something, perhaps candy. Point is, let that be a lesson to you about disobeying the third-person omniscient voice. Alas, the future of democracy is not difficult to imagine at all. For human beings, though the amount of hair on their bodies and slope of their foreheads may change, are a predictable lot. Democracy will continue to exist in that delicate balance between lofty ideals and human fallibility. The United States will not remain the globe's lone superpower because we simply aren't fucking at a rate commensurate with the world's emerging nations. Sooner or later, someone's going to be richer and more powerful. China's a good bet. They don't rule out India. They're scrappy. They already have nukes. And according to one recent study, every single Indian citizen is a computer genius who has already taken your job in programming. How did that feel? Get used to it.
Supplemental material. Classroom activities. Note to listener, in this chapter, classroom activities come before discussion questions, because in the future, everything will be upside down. 1. Lose hope. 2. Robots versus humans. Divide the class into robots and humans engaged in an epic battle of survival. To simulate post-apocalyptic combat, chart each side's academic achievement over the course of the semester. Highest grades win. But at what cost? 3. The year is 2571. You have been convicted of thought crimes against Overlord Zargax and sentenced to life imprisonment on the toxic desert penal colony planet of Tuxalan 9. Prove your innocence. 4. Time machine. Turn your class into a time machine by making the students perform tedious busy work for the entire morning while you read a John Grisham novel. When they're done, close your book, point to the clock and announce, "See, we're 3 hours in the future." 5. Construct a well-ventilated, insulated underground shelter capable of withstanding a nuclear attack. Make sure it has ample room to stock non-perishable foods and is hooked up to a fresh water supply. You'll probably want to have it completed before April of next year. What do you mean, why? Don't worry about it. Just do it. Discussion questions. 1. How will the changing demographic trends, specifically the increased prevalence of minorities, alter the socio-political landscape, blah, blah, blah? 2. How will electronic or e-voting change our democracy? Will it become an e-democracy? In your answer, put the letter E before as many words as possible. 3. Where do you see democracy 500 years from now? How about 502 years? 4. What form of government would you like to see after our democracy finally eats itself, then shits itself out, and then re-eats its own self-shit in 2007? Express your answer in tears. 5. Name 3 things about contemporary politics that seem like they're as bad as they could possibly be, but which we'll look back at in 10 years with nostalgia for how simple a time it was. 6. According to Nostradamus, in the castle of Figueras on a misty day, a sovereign prince will be born of an infamous woman. Surname of breeches on the ground will make him posthumous. Never was there a king so very bad in his provenance. How did he know? Chapter 9. the rest of the world. International House of Horrors. In this chapter, you will meet the rest of the world in 3 minutes. See the most common stereotypes reinforced. Learn nothing whatsoever about St. Kitts. Discover that denial ain't just a psychological coping mechanism. Find out in which countries you definitely don't want to get arrested.
Some of our more astute listeners may have noticed that in detailing the complex and bewildering institutions that comprise our government, we inadvertently called your attention to some slight imperfections in our otherwise perfect union. Inefficiencies, inequities, injustices, absurdities, hypocrisies, and an overall failure to live up to the lofty ideals expressed in our nation's founding documents, those types of things. Some of these readers may even feel angry. They may feel tempted to consider living someplace other than America, someplace freer, safer, less bomb-happy, less hated by the rest of the world, someplace like, oh, the rest of the world. And to these listeners we say, have you actually seen the rest of the world lately? Chances are the answer to that question is no. With recent travel bans, a slumping economy, and our nation's love affair with xenophobia, your exposure to other systems of government is limited at best. In fact, odds are you could name 5 fictional U.S. presidents more readily than 1 foreign prime minister. Quick, try it. See? So, in the interest of presenting the complete picture, the rest of the world, its peoples, systems of government, cultures, and histories have been encapsulated in the next few minutes. A bon voyage.
Africa.
The story of Africa in the modern age is one of war, disease, corruption, repression, and poverty. On the upside, there are tons of monkeys, and you never need a jacket. Africa was not always so dreadful. It was, after all, the birthplace of our species. Ancient Egypt was once the most advanced civilization on Earth. Rich tribal cultures flourished on the western shore for untold centuries. Meryl Streep even stopped by to grow coffee and bang Robert Redford. Still, critics note ancient Egypt was rife with slavery. Meryl Streep is overrated, and while early man may have originated in Africa, he migrated to other continents as soon as he could stand upright. Blame for Africa's modern-day ills can be laid squarely at the feet of 2 oppressors, white people and black people. Europeans' systematic rape of sub-Saharan Africa's resources, territory, and slaves cast the continent into centuries of misery. But when colonialism collapsed in the mid-20th century, many local black leaders thought, if the white man got rich and powerful by turning my homeland into an unrecognizable husk of sewage and mass graves, maybe I can too. So, is there hope for a truly democratic Africa? Long answer, only if continent-wide improvements in education, human rights, and public health are coupled with an aggressive and far-sighted debt relief program that breaks the cycle of subsistence farming and urban squalor. Short answer, no.
Australia.
Imagine American politics were a boomerang, and you threw that boomerang, and it came back to you exactly like it was, except now it had a dark, leathery suntan and was wearing corduroy shorts and an orange Ocean Pacific tank top. This gives you an idea of the surprising similarities between Australia and the United States. Other similarities, language, sort of. Wholesale slaughter of indigenous population. And geography. Like America, Australia has 2 or 3 important cities on the opposite coast and a whole lot of nothing in between. What we call flyover country, they call the outback. Oh, one other thing. Most of the white inhabitants are descended from hardened criminals who Mother England deliberately sent as far away as geographically possible to avoid contamination by their putrid gene pool.
China.
By the time you finish listening to this sentence, 3 million more Chinese people will have been born. That's life in the world's most populous country. Though its economy still lags behind that of many punier industrialized nations, rapacious first world capitalists are correct in their designation of China as a sleeping giant. But here's the rub. They're all a bunch of communists. Filthy, filthy communists. Okay, that smear doesn't have the zing it once had. But China is still a police state. That means things Americans take for granted are against the law in China. Freedom to practice Scientology, no matter how transparent a ruse it is. Freedom to publish a picture of President Bush with a Hitler mustache on your lame blog. Even the freedom to listen to Paul McCartney's horrible song, Freedom. The forces of globalization may yet change all this, but until that day comes, you are better off adopting one of their readily available babies, female only, and taking her to see Richard Gere stand side by side with the Dalai Lama as they make yet another plea for a free Tibet. And if you are lucky, Bjork will do a set.
The Middle East.
The rich history of the Middle East is well documented, so there is little we need to add by way of discouraging you from visiting there. From the fertile crescent of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers to the olive and pomegranate-strewn streets of Jerusalem, the story of man began in this magnificent region, and clearly, this region is where the story will end. From the day God chose one of the three different religions who claim this land as their own, the shit has been hitting the palm fronds. Perhaps God himself best explained the almost non-stop violence that has plagued the area.
Who amongst thee are my favored people? Jews, Christians, or Muslims? I don't know. I guess we'll just have to see who wants it more.
Latin America.
Whether you are a Marxist with camping skills or an ex-Nazi looking for a fresh start, no place says hola like Latin America. Mexico, Central America, and South America make up this region of 500 million people. Wait, it looks like 20 of them are making a run for it. Anyway, known for its diverse agricultural products, distinct rhythms, and massive foreign debt, Latin America is a wonderful destination for those dissatisfied with our government, but willing to try one our government has propped up. But be warned, you might have to head for the hills at a moment's notice, so pack light. When the coup happens, they don't take too kindly to foreigners and intellectuals, and it's a long, lonely drop from the C-130 to the South Atlantic below, especially when you're blindfolded.
Old Europe.
No region's stature has plummeted more over the past 100 years than Old Europe, a once dominant region now reduced to sucking at the geopolitical teat of the American hegemon. To be fair, they are very tired. When they weren't fighting each other, they spent the better part of the last millennium conquering the world and taking the good stuff home with them. You spend 1,000 years plundering and see if that doesn't slow you down a step. And what do they get for their troubles? Ungrateful colonies demanding their independence. And after they taught them how to play cricket. Well, the loose collection of social democracies making up Western Europe are not going to take it anymore. They've banded together to form a powerful coalition, the European Union, that will once again propel Europe to its rightful place amongst the world's most powerful, just as soon as they all adopt the same currency and sign their constitution and ratify their trade agreements. Wait, where's Belgium going? We wanted to show you the new logo.
Russia and Eastern Europe.
Remember the CCCP? What about the USSR? No? How about Rocky IV? Yeah, well, that's all over now. With the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the communist nations of the Soviet Union threw off the yoke of a failed political system and rushed to embrace Western-style capitalism. But like Lenny in Of Mice and Men, these retarded man-children did not know their own strength. Lacking infrastructure, experience, and understanding of market controls, Russia has been tossed into swirling chaos. Yes, Western goods and services are now available, but chances are those Levi's must first pass through the grubby hands of a bulbous-nosed mobster in a shiny tracksuit and $800 Bruno Mali loafers. He will kill you if you look at him funny. But first you will be tortured, and your disappearance will not be investigated. So that's Russia. As for Eastern Europe, particularly the Balkan region, it remains a powder keg of ethnic tension, where the Croats hate the Serbs hate the Kosovars, the Poles hate the Ukrainians, and everyone hates those goddamn Albanians. But by all accounts, Estonia is lovely.
Scandinavia.
Americans consider life in Scandinavia to be as sweet and white as a vanilla snow cone from the fjords of Bjornsen. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Iceland, and Finland have blended cold, hard, Teutonic efficiency with European social liberalism to create five of the cleanest nations on the planet. You can literally eat off the sidewalk in Copenhagen. Scandinavians enjoy the lowest levels of pollution, homelessness, and illiteracy in the world. And yet, most of them will commit suicide. Why? Because 6 months of glorious sunlight must cede to 6 months of spirit-crushing darkness. It is the yin and yang of Scandinavia. Full employment, but a minimum 50% income tax rate. This dilemma is perhaps most thoroughly manifested in Scandinavia's bikini teams, which consistently rank among the world's hottest even though the region's beaches suck.
Southeast Asia.
With its incredible natural beauty and crushing social problems, Southeast Asia offers a unique mix of paradise and hell. In more ways than one, South and Southeast Asia are where the action is. Obviously, the astonishing breadth and creativity of this region's sex trade is beyond this book's scope. However, we can still marvel at how far these economies have come. Today, some of the world's most dynamic economies and political cultures can be found here. The so-called Asian tiger economies have embraced a no-holds-barred brand of capitalism that, among other things, has given birth to a poaching industry so profitable, actual Asian tigers have been driven to extinction. With their 29-hour workdays and salaries in the high peanuts, South Asia is slowly destroying us.
Election 2004. George Walker Bush, hurdling the lowered bar.
Born on July 6, 1946, in New Haven, Connecticut, the young Bush had little time to enjoy his Tony surroundings. When Bush was but a boy, his father, fed up with the lack of oil in Connecticut, moved the family to Texas to fulfill his dream of being a magnate. The early years were rough, as the young Bush watched his father, George Sr., struggle just to find enough decent servants to put food on the table. Bush was a realist. He knew that to have his way made for him in the world, he would need the appearance of an excellent education. But from where? What New England preparatory school worth its salt would take a chance on a mediocre student from a powerful family? Luckily, all of them. George W. Bush attended Andover Academy, where he fared. Building on that momentum, he put himself through Yale, though only after earning the coveted Barbara Bush Scholarship. And then, war. After graduating Yale, some come see average, George Bush suddenly found himself eligible for the draft. He was at a crossroads. Should he enlist and fight a war he supported? Or was there perhaps a different, less dangerous route? There was, but it wouldn't be easy. The Texas Air National Guard selected only the elitist of the elite. George Bush would need a note. But as fate would have it, his father knew the people who could make things like that happen. 5 years later, with Vietnam winding down, it was clear George Bush had turned up for National Guard service most of the weekends he was required to. Still haunted by flashbacks that it was the weekend and he would have to report to the base, Bush tried to leave Vietnam behind and somehow begin having the pieces of his life put back together for him. Armed only with a Harvard MBA, a Rolodex of powerful oil business connections, and moxie, George Bush struck out. He was eager to start writing the story of his life. Chapter 1, Chapter 11. Bush proved uniquely adept at driving companies into the ground and was soon bankrupting larger and larger entities. It was a lesson in failing up he would not soon forget. And then, a chance meeting with the Vice President of the United States changed George Bush's life. The Vice President saw something in the young man. That's when George Bush Sr. offered George Bush Jr. his support in a run for governor of Texas. Having never held any elected office, George Bush found governing fulfilling. While he wasn't able to bankrupt Texas, he did add many new and interesting particles to its air. Always a friend to the energy industry, Bush tripled the amount of electricity flowing through Death Row. Even the retarded took notice. Texas tamed, Bush turned his eyes to the Oval Office. The 2000 election was quintessential Bush. He lost the popular vote, thus winning the presidency. In just 4 years, President Bush has streamlined our bloated job market, tossed over the unnecessary ballast of international allies, and ensured that our military does not become bored and complacent. He is widely expected to lose this election, serve a second term, and then be named emperor in 2008.
John F. Kerry, monogrammed for greatness.
The quest started early. Upon being slapped at birth, Kerry applied for and was awarded the first of his 27 Purple Hearts. At 3 months old, already 6'4" and craggy, Kerry faced the nursery with a stentorian manner and an inherited lack of humor. His father, Richard, had been a pilot in World War II and his post-war recovery from tuberculosis was considered one of his lighter moments. The Carey family was close-knit, with a patrician bearing and high expectations for success. Growing up, John and his siblings passed many an evening competing in jaw-squaring and blazer-wearing contests. On Christmas Eve, the whole clan would gather around an old upright piano and stare silently at one another. The young Carey was unlikable, but made up for it with drive and arrogance. His eye was always on the legislative prize. Determined to prove his precious initials were no fluke, Carey spent countless childhood hours practicing ventriloquism on the chance that in student council elections he could nominate and second himself without detection. The one area Carey was decidedly un-Kennedy-esque was with the ladies. He lost his virginity his senior year only after an intense lobbying and letter-writing campaign aimed at persuading the school slut to grant him franking privileges. After prep school, Carey matriculated at Yale, where his classmates gave him the playful nickname Senator Carey. Upon graduation, inspired by his initial sake, Carey enlisted in the Navy. He served as a swift boat officer in the Mekong Delta and was constantly trying to get his boat sunk so he could rescue people. Upon completing an act of heroism, Carey would receive a medal, which he would then hold up in front of the poster of JFK in his room and shout, "I'm closing in, bitch." Carey returned from Vietnam, however, to find the nation had changed. War heroes weren't writing profiles in Courage and swimming in pools of hot and cold running poontang. They were reviled. Perplexed, Carey consulted his WWJFKD bracelet and emerged an adamant anti-war activist, co-founding Vietnam Veterans Against the War. In his televised testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1971, Carey famously asked the panel, "How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?" before adding, "Huh? Pretty quotable, no?" But Carey's eloquence failed to ignite the passion young Kennedy had stirred years earlier. His lifelong plan to succeed Kennedy had been missing two crucial elements, a corrupt, ruthless billionaire father and charisma. Carey was at a crossroads. Where could a terse, stentorian know-it-all succeed if not politics? The answer? Law. Carey received his law degree from Boston College and went to work as a prosecutor in Middlesex County. He remembers those days fondly as great bio fodder. Ultimately, Carey realized that following in the path of John Fitzgerald Kennedy was a daunting task. The times and his early death had conspired to create a myth around the young Kennedy too great to match, even for one sharing his initials. John F. Carey knew he could never be John F. Kennedy. But look at Teddy. He's a United States senator, and he's half retarded. If Carey could simply remain upright and pantsed, it would be a snap. 25 years later, John F. Carey is a successful 4-term senator from Massachusetts.
A Night Out With.
While you could pick a president based on voting records, stances on various issues, or foreign or domestic policies, pollsters have found most voters choose a candidate based on more intangible criteria, namely likability. In modern media parlance, this translates to, which candidate would you rather have a beer with? In 2000, it was widely accepted that Al Gore had a superior command of the issues as well as experience in government. George Bush, on the other hand, had the highest Bennigan's Happy Hour Q rating since U.S. Grant. To settle the issue once and for all, we gave Rob Corddry and Ed Helms $30 in petty cash and sent them out for a night of drinks and discussion with the current presidential candidates.
Ed Helms, My Night with President George W. Bush.
The president ambled into the seldom-seen wood-paneled rumpus room located in the White House basement. I had wanted to go out to a jazz bar in nearby Georgetown, but was told it would be a logistical nightmare and that the president had deemed the idea faggy. The president flashed his trademark grin. "Hiya, Stretch." Stretch is the special nickname he reserves for me and every other member of the press corps over 5'9". Bush then gave a quick wave to the 7 Secret Service agents who surrounded me in a protective phalanx. "Evening, Shorty, Grumbles, Buzz, Scarlet, Patsy, Snagglepuss, Asian guy." The Secret Service men all gave little waves back, except for the one nicknamed Buzz, whose hands were occupied by the rifle he happened to be pointing at my head. "So," said a familiar voice behind me, "what do you have, O'Douls, Caliber? We don't stock the strong stuff here." I turned around to find Dick Cheney had quietly slipped into the bar. I asked for no duels, and Cheney ordered three of them, one for each of us. We sat down on bar stools, Cheney carefully positioning himself between Bush and me. We uncapped our non-beers and drank for a moment in silence. I knew I was not allowed to discuss the current situation in Iraq, or anything pertaining to the Middle East. The economy was also off-limits, as were the first 40 years of Bush's life, the activities of his daughters, any legislation passed or signed during his term of office, his governorship in Texas, and his relationship with his father. As I searched for a question, the only sound in the room was Bush opening and closing the tiny paper parasol he had demanded with his beer. He opened and closed it, opened and closed it, opened and closed it, until Cheney finally reached over, gently took the parasol from Bush's hands, and tucked it in his jacket pocket. "So," I asked, leaning forward to see past Cheney, "how's Laura?" "She's fine," said a voice behind me. I turned around to see Communications Director Karen Hughes. She sipped from a virgin daiquiri and took a seat to my right. "She's perfectly fine. The president loves her very much." Bush vigorously nodded his agreement at this sentiment. There was another long, awkward pause. "How about them Mets?" I asked. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan tapped me on the shoulder. I hadn't even heard him come in. "I don't think I should have to tell you that the president loves all baseball teams equally," he said. "He believes baseball embodies the freedom that God has given to all Americans." The president reached for a second paper parasol, but Cheney smacked his hand before he could reach the bowl. I decided to try one more time. "What do you..." And with that, a finger fell gently to my lips, silencing me. It was Condoleezza Rice. "Please," she said. "It's been a long day. The president is very tired." Cheney nudged Bush, who hopped off the stool to his feet. As the president strode confidently out of the room behind Dr. Rice, he turned, winked, and shot me double guns. He pointed to the Adams Family pinball machine in the corner. "Knock yourself out," he said with a devilish grin. "It's rigged so you can play for free." Our night out was over. It was 7:15 p.m., and I was alone with three O'Doul's bottles and a $10.50 bar tab. It was the greatest night of my life.
Rob Corddry, My Night with Senator John Kerry.
"Want to see a picture of my hog?" Before I could answer, the junior senator from Massachusetts whipped out a small wallet-sized photo of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. In so doing, he knocked over his can of Iron City beer onto my lap. "Son of a fuck shit!" he spat out, quickly wiping up the spill with an oil-stained bandana. "My bad, man." The senator signaled our bartender for another round. I thanked him for the brew. "Don't thank me, thank St. Teresa." That was his nickname for Mrs. Hines Carey, a nickname he tossed off with greater frequency as cans of Iron City gave way to shots of Jack. Carey leaned into me. "Terry's fucking great," he snarled, before mentioning the actress Morgan Fairchild and that he had once tapped that when it still meant something. John Kerry is a regular guy, real salt of the earth. In fact, all regulars at Leon Shamrock Pub and Grill in Boston's North End have been told precisely that each and every time Kerry pops in, usually with a camera crew or an intrepid reporter like myself. They've gotten used to his boozy ramblings and have learned to recognize his warning signs. My heads up came as a glancing blow to my temple, which knocked me off my bar stool and onto the floor. As I came to, I could see interns restraining Kerry by the fringes of his born-to-kill biker's vest. Red-faced and spitting, he yelled at me, "Police action! The two pieces of shrapnel still in my ass say it was a war!" Truth be told, I hadn't actually called Vietnam a police action, but instead had said, "It's getting late, Senator. I should go." Kerry's chief campaign strategist helped me to my feet. "Don't take it personally," he said. "The senator's just so strong on defense, his warrior's rage gets the best of him sometimes." Another campaign aide clapped his hands twice, instantly summoning two large bearded veterans who went by the names Dusty and TJ. They escorted me outside and told me to stay there until the senator cooled off. As I hit the night air, I could taste blood in my mouth. Just then, the door of the pub swung open and Kerry bounded out. I braced myself for another stinging punch, but instead, he swung a sober arm around me,
pulled his face in close and whispered, "Don't worry, it's cool. I'm not even drunk. Just be sure to write about the part where I hit you."
Well, that's all the time we have here for America the Book, the audiobook. By completing this audiobook, you are now qualified to found your own democracy. Congratulations. The bad news is there are no new lands upon which to do your founding, no new oceans to cross or jungles to clear. We know exactly what is out there beyond them thar hills. In fact, we GPS'd it. The good news is many of the existing lands out there are fixer-uppers, filled with willing, desperate, broken, and hopeless people. You might even be one yourself. And if you are, representative democracy, for all its flaws, still offers you and your fellow cold and huddled masses the best chance of improving your lot in life. Hell, even if there isn't a Jefferson or Hamilton among you, if you just smash together the basic ideas of this book, you're bound to wind up with something better than North Korea. Now go out there and make your fathers proud.
This concludes America the Book, the audiobook. We hope you'll use what you learned in this instructional program to go out and change the world. And by change, we don't mean just adding your small but earnest effort to a larger cause like saving coral reefs. We mean changing the entire world, making every place exactly like America. The point is, think locally, act globally. This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart presents America the Book, the audiobook, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced, directed, and text abridged by John McElroy. Post-production by Gashouse Productions and CDM Studios. Production supervised by Linda Ross.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.